You're listening to the Gut Munchers Podcast.
Hey gang, welcome to episode 3 of the Gut Munchers Podcast. As always, I'm your host, John. I'm going to be a little bit different this month. The show's going to be structured just a wee bit differently because my man Jason the Animal Pain moved to Japan. And we did get part of the show in the can before he left, but unfortunately, due to some technical difficulties, can't use the audio. So you're stuck with me for some of the intros, and I'm going to do this solo. But again, this is episode 3 of the Gut Munchers Podcast. This will be our March 2009 show. We got a big show for you this month. We have an interview with director Bill Rebane, who did a bunch of classic drive-in movies. Two of which we're going to review on the show: Demons of Ludlow and The Giant Spider Invasion. And I would like to say right now, I really appreciate Steve for jumping in and helping me out at the last minute for recording both of those segments. But that's not the only thing you're going to hear Steve on, because Steve Benningfield, the newest addition to the show, is actually the first installment of Sensei Cinema, where we discuss all things Asian cinema with Steve, is coming up. Let's see what else we got. Oh, we've got the first installment of the Mom and Pop Video Shop with Ed Demko, where I visit that and we talk some old VHS and old movies there. So it's an action-packed show. Two reviews, the Video Shop and Sensei Cinema. So, like I said, guys, it's just me in this segment, and I hate hearing myself talk, and I probably imagine you guys do too. So let's take a quick break, and we'll come right back, and let's jump in with some Sensei Cinema. So we'll be back right after this on the Gut Munchers Podcast.
Deep, deeper, deepest, from beneath the living, from beyond the dead, to the depths of Hell's Ocean. Shockwaves. Something unspeakable has risen. Shockwaves from Joseph Brenner, rated PG. Starring the masters of shock, Peter Cushing and John Carradine, plunging you deep, deeper, deepest into shockwaves. The deep end of horror.
Welcome to Sensei Cinema with Steve Benningfield. Hey, Steve, how you doing?
Hey, pretty good. How you?
Not bad, not bad at all. Well, this is a first new feature on the show here with you, and you want to tell people what you're going to be doing a little bit?
Yeah, basically, I have two loves of movies, horror, and then also Asian movies, kung fu, gunplay, all kinds of stuff. So there's a lot of horror stuff going on, and you guys got that covered, so I'm picking up on the Asian side.
Cool. I'm a big fan of that stuff as well. So, well, this is our first segment, first time around with Sensei Cinema. What do you got for us?
Well, in anticipation of Cinema Wasteland, I picked a movie that kind of unusual, but you would never think of it for this actress. But Christina Lindbergh did two movies in Japan. And the one I'm going to talk about first is Sex and Fury. Cool. From 1973.
Cool.
So she's not, Christina Lindbergh is not the she's like a secondary player, but the main star, I hope I can pronounce it, Riku Aiki. she starred in a lot of Pinky Violent movies, and this probably falls into the category of Pinky Violence. She stars as Ocho. Basically, she's a gambler and a pickpocket. Okay. And throughout the movie, she can't help herself, and she usually pickpockets people for no reason. But basically, the movie starts off when she runs into an anarchist and then hides him out. He basically, I don't know, causing a scene at this diplomatic function. And they see her at, she goes to a gambling den, and one of her friends cheats, and then he properly gets dispatched
by the Yakuza.
Yeah,
awesome. I love Yakuza.
And then this is only like in 13 minutes in, and then she takes revenge on him, and then basically she gets naked, and we have a naked sword fight in the snow, and it's pretty entertaining. Let's just say that
naked sword fight in the snow. That's awesome.
Yeah, luckily she's the only one naked.
Okay.
And then she goes back to her dying friend, and he wants her to visit his daughter in another city. So she basically goes there and tracks her down. She also meets up with the anarchist dude, and she accidentally pickpockets him, and she has a locket. And she opens the locket, and it's a picture of Christina Lindbergh, which is her character's name is Christina. So no stretch there. And it's pretty cool to hear her speak English, because at that point she was very, very, very rough English. But from there, she meets up with a den of other pickpockets who evidently she's known before, and she finds out the daughter is being slaved out to this high-ranking guy. And in the course of trying to win her back, they have to play a card game, and he brings in Christina Lindbergh to play a card game with her. And pretty tense card game, almost like Casino Royale. And during the middle of the card game, there's a ruckus, and the anarchist dude breaks in with his buddies, and there's like a big sword fight. And then Christina Lindbergh pulls out a gun and starts shooting the guys in their hands. And it comes up on this the anarchist dude, and that's basically she had fell in love with him when he came to Europe sometime before. Mm-hmm. And she basically lets him go. And then after that, they go back and play the card game like nothing happened. But Christina Lindbergh was winning the card game, but unfortunately she's distracted now with visions of her Japanese boyfriend in her head, and she ends up losing the game, and she gets a little whooping out of it from her caretaker. Evidently she's a spy trying to get some documents, secret documents. So the guy, the gangster, ends up giving the girl back, and the girl tells Ochi about the tattoo on the guy's back, which is a deer. And she has like a flashback, and three gangsters killed her father. And one of them had a deer tattoo. So Ochi is out for revenge, and she tracks down him and dispatches him pretty quickly with some poison. And she heads out for the other two suspects. One of them is a little bit more closer to home than the other. Later on in the movie, we're treated to a Christina Lindbergh whipping Ochi with a cat of nine tails, which was kind of entertaining. So, it basically ends with a lot of a massive sword fight, and there actually was a sequel to this movie called Female Yakuza Tail, which is also on a DVD. So I definitely would give this like a 3.5 out of 5, or 4 rather. Definitely a great movie. Yeah, I mean, I didn't like it the first time I watched it as much, but after watching it again, if you don't care for the story that much, which I don't know why you wouldn't, there's so much lavish sets, and the color just pops out. I mean, it's so crazy, vivid. So definitely very... Very stunning looking, and Christina Lindbergh looks like, you know, you could almost touch her. It's so crystal, and this is not even on Blu-ray. So I mean, it's just a very great looking movie.
Excellent. Seems like the story is kind of crazy and wacky too. So
yeah,
3.5 out of 4, huh?
I would give it that.
And I gotta ask, dude, does Christina Lindbergh disrobe?
Yes.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
That comes to half. It was only a 3 before.
Oh, so that gives you another half star.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So what else you got for us?
Well, also, I was just rewatching some movies. This one movie was re-released. It came out on Dimension a long time ago, and I watched it. I didn't really care for it. So I got the new release of Fist of Fury from 1994 with Jet Li, and definitely... changed my mind about how much I liked it. I really liked it a lot more this time. It's basically Fist of Fury is basically a remake of Fist of Fury, which in our country was known as Chinese Connection with Bruce Lee. And basically, it's the same story, but they built on it a lot. It takes place in 1937. And basically, Jet Li plays Chen Jun, and he's in school in Japan. At this time, Japan was basically occupying China and basically treating the Chinese like dogs. I mean, in the original Fist of Fury, they had a park and they had a sign that said no Chinese or no dogs or Chinese into the park. So they really, for I don't know how they allowed it, but they really treated the Chinese pretty bad in their own country.
Well, Jet Li's invaded them, dude. And
yeah,
when the Japanese military is there bombing cities and the Raymond Nanking and everything. I guess it's kind of not much you can do about the park.
Yeah, I guess you have to give up something. But Jet Li's at school, and all his other students are Japanese, and they start, you know, a little ruckus, and then basically Jet Li lays a smackdown, which I remember it's really a really quick and good fight, breaking legs left and right, and then the teacher, you know, breaks it up, and basically Jet Li tells him about who his master was, and then he tells him that his master is now dead. And Jet Li basically, you know, he returns home to find out what's going on. So he goes back to the dojo and visits the other people. And they basically find out he had a fight with a rival master, actually a Japanese master. And they find out that he died in the battle, which Jet Li heads over to the dojo and challenges the master for a fight. And basically whoops him, and he says, you couldn't have beat my master if he was healthy. So they basically dig up the master, and one of the funnier parts is that they bring a American doctor there, and they cut the master open, take a piece of his liver, put it in some kind of fluid, and he shakes it around, and he goes, he's poisoned. So I don't know. I guess that's all you need is some
advanced
water.
Medical technology.
And he knew what the poison was, too, from the water. So that was pretty funny. And then from there, it's just, you know, he's trying to look into it, and they're finding suspects, and basically it comes back to a conspiracy with a Japanese general trying to, you know, undermine the Chinese, and basically leads to a bunch of good fights. There's the fight at the end is pretty brutal. The general is like a really tall dude, and he's just like breaking legs and breaking backs left and right. So there's a lot of good fights in this movie. And like I said, I didn't care for it as much as when I first saw it a couple years ago. But I was reading online that, you know, that people consider this one of the best Jet Li movies, and I would have to agree. So I definitely would give this a 3 out of 4 as well.
So do you think this is you know, the first one's kind of an odd, almost like an exploitation movie out of Japan?
Yes.
One is just a more traditional, like kung fu movie.
Yeah, I mean this movie is basically it's basically a kung fu movie. I mean this has a fight choreographer by Yi Wu Ping, which there's not a whole lot of flying around and stuff, but some wire work. There's a little bit of tribute to Bruce Lee in his workout scheme. I remember seeing footage of Bruce Lee doing push-ups on his fingertips. And doing them one-handed on his fingertips, and then Jet Li does the same in there. I guess it's a little tribute to Bruce Lee, but this is kind of like in the cycle of early 90s. There's a lot of these kung fu or Hong Kong action kung fu movies that came out, and definitely with Jet Li, he starred in a lot of those.
Cool. Well, speaking of Hong Kong action movies, you have another one. The last one you're going to talk about is something that I haven't seen yet, but I'm really excited because of the director. And I want you to go ahead and talk a little bit about this one.
Well, this is the newest movie from John Woo, which he returned back to Hong Kong. This is the largest budgeted movie in Hong Kong history. It's $80 million U.S. They broke it up into two parts. Now, added together, this movie is almost a little over 4 hours long with both parts. Right now, they released... Late last year they released the part one of Red Cliff, and this is a really this story takes place, I believe, in the Romance of the Three Kingdoms. It's a very old book in Japan, China, but this takes place around 208 A.D. and the emperor wants to take control of a couple of larger spots of China, which is broken up into three spots, he gets his commander basically dares the emperor to let him do it, and they let him do it, and they start going into southern China, which is ruled by a man called Liu Bei or something. I hope that's pronounced right. And then basically they try to take their armies in to invade the one of these large villages, but basically Liu Bei is having his men evacuate and also hopefully protect the civilians, which is hundreds of people leaving the area from the invaders, which leads to a really good action scene with the battles. It's a really good battle there. I mean, there's people left and right. These battles are not...
Are they really big and huge and epic? Or, I mean, like, we're talking about army-sized battles and...
Yes, I mean, yes, in this first battle, it was very epic, and there's a lot of spears. It's basically almost all on horseback, and then at some point, a lot of them get off horseback in battle. There's one homage to another John Woo movie, Hard Boiled, when one of the commanders saves a baby and straps it to the back, and then he keeps on fighting. So that's pretty cool. And they rescue the baby back. And so at this point, they want to team up with the other group, and that's led by Sun Quan. So they allow the ambassador, I guess, I'm not really sure. He's like a chief advisor to Liu Bei, and he travels to the land of Sun Quan and tries to convince him to allow or get some assistance so they can form an alliance to crush this and retake the emperor, get him out of power. And basically, this is where it leads to some good scenes. Basically, he goes and visits Tony Leung, which he is a legend in these kind of movies. He's been in Hong Kong movies forever. I remember, you know, so he plays like the viceroy commander of the army. And then it basically the advisor visits him and sees the army. And it leads to one of the weirdest scenes because he's trying to convince him for help. And they play these things called zifers or zifers. They're some kind of string instruments that you play on your knee. And it's like they have a little battle of the bands with these Zypher things.
Really?
Yeah, it's pretty funny. But and from that, he can say that he's a trustworthy man and all this stuff. So, and so they basically team up at that point, and they're ready for battle. There is a secondary battle there where the it's almost like Braveheart. These have these shields, and they use them to blind the opposite side of the army or the other army, and. And it's kind of a strange point because it's almost like a cliffhanger because it does end with the other army's navy coming into the bay or whatever you want to call it of the that country, and there's like thousands of ships, thousands of CG ships everywhere, and then we have this really long track shot going out following a dove, of course, from John Woo's trademark. Following it all the way into the command center on one of these ships, and basically we see the land, and basically we see that country and all the ships, and basically they light it on fire to symbolize the battle's about to begin, and then that basically ends the movie. So I mean, this is a lot different from usual John Woo movies, but as far as the action and it never drags a lot. It does some spots. There's some sub. Stories that kind of drag a little bit, but not enough to warrant a negative review. So I definitely would say this is like a 3 out of 4, and I'm hopefully going to be seeing the part 2 here in a few weeks. So definitely three good movies there to track down.
So you say the action's not quite, you know, normal chaotic John Woo, but it does seem to be interesting for you then?
Yeah, I mean, it's a different kind of action. There's no guns, of course, and stuff like that. So we got a lot of spear fighting, a few sword fights. He carries on the very epic action that I don't think he's done before. I know he did Wind Talkers with World War II action. But this one, I'm not sure if he's more at home with this type of storytelling or what. But it's kind of a change, and it definitely wasn't expecting this from John Woo, kind of historic drama.
Cool, very cool. Well, I think that's a pretty good episode one of Sensei Cinema with Steve Benningfield. I appreciate you stopping by and contributing to the show. And also, I wanted to make sure that people knew where to catch your own project, because for those of you who might not know, Steve actually does something that I listen to whenever he does a new show, and that's Eurocult. Where can they find Eurocult?
Well, I do a show every week or two, but it's at mypodcast/Eurocult, or you can just go to mypodcast.com and just run a search for Eurocult.
Okay, well, thanks for stopping by, and we'll see you next month for another episode.
Alrighty, bow to your sensei.
You are invited to witness a shattering adventure in total fright.
Watch me when I kill!
Prepare yourself for shock after shock, for horror beyond belief, and spine-tingling suspense that never lets go.
Watch me when I kill!
You have never experienced the sheer terror, the menacing suspense that awaits you when you see...
Watch me when I kill!
You will watch it happen. You will be there when the unseen killer stalks his unsuspecting victims. Scream if you wish, but nothing will stop him. Are you ready to accept this invitation?
Watch me when I kill!
Rated R.
Just want to thank Steve again for stopping by and doing that first installment of Sensei Cinema. So we're going to get to the Bill Rebane interview right now. I had an opportunity to talk to Bill Rebane because basically what I did is I found him on the internet and I sent him an email with my phone number, and it was very strange because that was about 2 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, and I was walking to my car at the end of work a couple hours later, 3 hours later, and my phone rings and I picked it up and I'm like, hello, and it's like, hi, this is Bill Rebane. And I was like, what, man? No way, because it never occurred to me that the guy would actually pick up the phone and call me, but he did. And from there, I was able to schedule an interview with him, and it went really well, and I guess that's about it. So without further ado, let's get to the Bill Rebane interview.
That's how Terror at Half Day was born. I realized at that time what the marketplace was looking for and what was always a safe thing. I was an avid reader of Variety, following up on the industry trends. And because of Twist Craze, I had spent some time in Hollywood, met a lot of people, and hung around with all the right people, I guess, and I think safely I can say I had a good feeling for the pulse of the industry and realized that it would be relatively cheap, inexpensive to make a monster movie, so to say. And rather than trying going the Frankenstein route or the Dracula route, I took the science fiction aspect, and because we had just sent, in the early 60s, we had sent the first astronaut into space, if you remember. Well, that kind of spurred an astronaut. You know, what happens if you send an astronaut up, something happens up there. And so I sat down and wrote a script. I had never written a screenplay before. But the investor and friend of mine that was involved in it liked it, and he happened to be a very frustrated, ego-driven, wannabe actor who had a little money. His name was George Perry, who played the part of a scientist in the picture. And I think we started the picture with $40,000 in bank. And because it was Chicago, I was required to go union. And Herschel had done a picture just before that, a year or two before that, called Prime Time, which was a little risque. I think it was a love story, a beach party type picture with some nudity in it. And he had chosen to shoot it himself, non-union. And we officed at the same studio at the time, called United Film and Recording Studios. And the union came down so hard on him that he got into a fight with the union boss. They wanted to storm down the doors of the studio, actually physically break down the doors of the studio, stop Herschel Lewis from proceeding with his effort.
I can see why when it came time to do your film, you decided to go union.
Exactly, that was the deal. And the studio owner, who was a mentor of mine, also advised me. He says, you know, it's not that much more effort and money to do it right, and he had all the right connections. So I called the union boss. I said, I need a director of photography, and he fixed me up with that. Went to another studio, got a crew. That was union. And in those days, Chicago was filled with commercial film studios. And they all thought I was totally nuts. I mean, who's this kid trying to do a feature film in Chicago? Unheard of. Well, we got it started. So for about 2 weeks, we raised holy hell in Chicago. And through good political connections at that time in Chicago, and I had a good attorney, new Mayor Daley, the old Mayor Daley, we pulled some strings, and I got the city to block off Michigan Avenue and Oak Street. I don't know if you know what that is.
Yes. Yeah.
Michigan is the main thoroughfare, and nobody blocks Michigan Avenue off during rush hour traffic at 5:30. But we did. I had the third district of the Chicago Police Department involved in this thing. Had all the squad cars I wanted, all the fire engines I wanted, all the civil defense units I wanted.
Help and I hired,
and that was right after we had finished exterior photography outside of Chicago on a union basis and started running a little short on money. So I had all these sequences lined up and all this action and these production values lined up. So I had to hire Herschel as a cinematographer and his partner, who was also a cinematographer, Bill Johnson, to shoot that sequence. And for one afternoon and evening, we pretty much had Michigan Avenue, the lower level of Wacker Drive, blocked off for the purposes of our picture. And it went reasonably well, considering my inexperience in directing at that time. But shortly after that, the money ran out. We tried like hell to raise more money, but here we were with that. Pretty much half-finished picture. I made some contacts in Los Angeles of people that might be able to help, and brought in a line producer. And we again went out and shot for several days and took it a little step further until it was all awash, really. And then I said, Herschel, what do we do? So he screened the footage, and Allied Theaters of Illinois screened the footage that we had in the can. Mm-hmm. And Allied Theaters had numerous exhibitors from downstate Illinois and their entire staff of bookers. And they sent me a letter saying that you have it looks like a very playable picture with a lot of promise. And we would love to book it when you're done with it. Well, long story short, that's basically at the time when Herschel took it over. And it was a kind of a coup de grace deal. He bought the entire footage, the negative footage. Okay. And he was going to edit it and do what he wanted to do with it. That's how it turned out to be Monster Go Go.
So that's when he changed the name. And did he shoot more footage, or did he pretty much just use whatever you had?
Oh, he shot more footage. He shot stuff. I had no part in the editing. As a matter of fact, I think the only thing I insisted on, because I didn't know how it was going to turn out or what he was going to do, but nevertheless, I wanted the credit. We agreed that I would retain the credit of directing. That was basically the whole deal. The rest is history.
So then I noticed that there's at least according to what I've been able to find, there's like a pretty long gap between that movie and then Invasion from Inner Earth. Did you go back to doing shorts or?
No, I actually, I'm trying to remember the time frame here, but at one point I came back from Germany. I was traveling quite a bit to Germany because I had a partner over there who owned a major production facility, and it was much more conducive to doing more feature films, so I traveled back and forth and ended up representing the studio in the United States as a businessman, actually, and get American producers to come over to our studio to shoot in Germany because the rate of the dollar at that time was like 4-1. It was cheaper to shoot overseas.
Okay. So then, I was always kind of fascinated that a lot of the movies at that point out, you end up shooting a lot of stuff in Wisconsin. How'd that come about?
Well, that was after a long, long time of traveling back and forth to commuting between Hamburg, Germany, Hollywood, and Chicago, getting business and putting productions together that could be shot there. My family still lived in Chicago, and I was always traveling by myself. And I also did a number of industrial films and corporate image films in Chicago for a producer friend of mine. And I kind of got exhausted, burnout, from doing too many things at once. I decided to take a trip to Wisconsin to actually go fishing. And on that fishing trip, I strictly coincidentally, I ran into a situation of a real estate deal that to buy a farm, which I did, and called my wife and said, "Honey, we're moving out of Chicago, we're moving to Wisconsin. I just bought a farm." Well, that farm was the beginning of the studio that we built. And the reason I was able to make that happen is because my a producer friend in Chicago who was very well connected and had a lot of industrial and corporate clients continued to call me and if I could do a direct or shoot a half-hour corporate image film or what have you. So I was commuting at the first 2 years or 3 years in Wisconsin. I was commuting back and forth to Chicago or wherever to produce, direct, and edit, and whatever. There was industrial films, corporate image films, for fairly big clients. Matter of fact, some major clients. To name a few, the Teamsters Union, the Republican Party, State Farm Insurance, Wausau Insurance Companies.
And these were all actually on 35, or?
Most on 35 or 16.
Okay.
And by that time, I had become, I would say, and the term, the best used term for that, I would imagine, is filmmaker. I was a seasoned filmmaker by that time. And with a producer that had a lot of faith and trust in me, and I delivered. And the income from that enabled me to go back to Wisconsin and live in Wisconsin and pretty much do my own thing and build up my own reservoir of equipment, post-production equipment, cameras and what have you. So by the time Invasion from Inner Earth came around, I had accumulated enough equipment, 16 Aeroflex cameras and lighting equipment, what have you, to pretty much be able to do it on my own. And then the problem became the crew, because there were no experienced, seasoned people in the Wisconsin North Woods. So I drew my my crew and key people from California, Chicago, sometimes Milwaukee. And until I decided to make a feature film, which of course was Invasion from Inner Earth.
So where'd that idea come from? And two questions, actually. Where'd the idea come from? And when you were shooting the film, were you targeting a certain market, like maybe the drive-ins, or were you just shooting something, hopefully, to get somebody to pick it up and distribute it?
You know, at that time, I was like any other hopeful feature filmmaker. I was reasonably well aware of the marketplace. I looked for something that was that I could write by myself, shoot by myself, and totally have total control over. And yes, and penetrate the what you'd call the drive-in market. By the way, the name of Invasion was the original title was The Selected.
Okay. I believe I saw the copy that I saw was even under one of the other titles. I think it was They that I found it under. But
I don't know where they came up with They, but the original title was The Selected.
Cool.
And it was written by my wife and myself because I was trying to get out of the industrial film field, which never, ever stopped, by the way. I kept doing that as I went along. But Invasion was, I called in a friend of mine from Los Angeles, a cinematographer, Jack Willoughby, to help out. And He and a local crew of, I think, about four, five people decided to do it in 16 millimeter.
Where did you draw your cast from for that movie?
Stevens Point, Wisconsin. University of Stevens Point.
Okay. And then not long after you did that film, you followed it up with, I believe it's Rana, the Legend of Shadow Lake?
Oh, that After Invasion from Inner Earth, which, by the way, was open in Wausau, Wisconsin, at the Grand Theater there. We had a huge premiere there because actually it was the first feature film made in Wisconsin, entirely in Wisconsin, with an entire Wisconsin crew and cast. I mean, a real homegrown effort. So the doors were open to premiere this thing in a big way. You know, remember, in those days to be a filmmaker, you had to be a promoter as well.
Okay.
If you didn't know how to promote something, you might as well pack up and get out.
So you promoting. Actually did you actually hit the road and yourself and try to sell the film?
Oh, well, I did. Of course, by that time I had enough connections to pick up the phone and call bookers or call people in Los Angeles and make connections and make things happen. I had that, and I knew that before I started it, that once I make it, I would have the means and the promotional know-how to launch it. But after Invasion, there was a 2-year time period where I had to go back to corporate image and industrial films because my producer was very busy, and I was the key person for him to travel and take a crew and go wherever he needed me to go and shoot. But at that time, I had such a nice post-production setup at the studio, or at my home in Wisconsin, that I was able to go wherever I needed to go and take the finished exposed footage back to Wisconsin, sit in my own editing room and do the whole post-production work myself and deliver the finished product. So after Invasion, I did a series of four, what you would call crime prevention films.
Okay.
In conjunction with the retired FBI agents for the National Banking Associations. And I wrote them, produced them, directed them, and shot them.
We did the educational films.
With a thought in mind that I'm not making an industrial film, but I'm making actually a mini feature. And I wrote the scripts in such a fashion that these weren't just trite, knock them over the head industrial films or training films, but that they were entertaining as well. In other words, they had a storyline. They were story-driven material, putting the message within the concept of the storyline.
Mm-hmm.
And they became successful, and I met a fellow by the name of Richard Huff in Madison, who was also a industrial film producer and had his tongue hanging out to do something in the theatrical field. We became very good friends, and
He wanted to know what the industry, what the feature film business was all about. And from what I knew, we brainstormed this situation and came up with this idea of doing something with spiders.
Okay.
And it started out as a spider horror film, with the spiders being no bigger than tarantulas.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the first script that we put together was called, I think, Silent Night, Alien Night. Alien Night. That was the original title of the giant spider invasion.
Okay.
And I took the concept of the script out to Hollywood, to a distributor, Group One. And he had heard about the invasion from an Earth project, and he liked the concept of the giant the spiders. There was no talk about giant spiders at that time. As we got deeper into it, he asked the question, well, how big can you make these spiders? I said, well, I figure maybe a foot and a half. And you make them bigger. I said, maybe you could do them 3 or 4 feet. And he says, that's great. He says, that's what we need. We need a big spider. So from there on, the concept of the spider grew to gigantic sizes. The problem was that at that time, we had already set a preliminary budget. I think the first budget was around, we figured we could do it for about $200,000,
$250,000.
Okay. Ultimately, it grew to $210,000. But the spiders kept getting bigger. Budget stayed at $310,000. Actually, we went over $10,000.
Now, did you have the effects people on giant spiders? Were these people you brought in from like California, or were these local people that just knew how to do it? Or,
well, the special effects, the primary special effects guy was Dick Albain, who was a seasoned Hollywood special effects expert. But he had no idea about how big the spider was going to get, and that wasn't part of his job. So we had to go to local resources, a local welder who had a used car shop or a welding shop and junkyard, and another guy by the name of Bob Millay, who was a friend of mine, had done some stunts. He was a homemade special effects man from Chicago. He and I brainstormed this thing because we were stuck. We had everything going for us, a distribution deal, money being raised in Madison, and here we had to make a spider 25 feet in diameter. I hadn't a clue of how we're going to do that until my friend Bob Millay came up and says, what if we take a Volkswagen chassis and create a body over the chassis and make it happen that way? And then hydraulics came into the picture. Yes, we could do it with hydraulics, except hydraulics are very expensive. And Dick Albain in Los Angeles said impossible. If he was involved with it, he would have to have a $50,000 budget to start with. So it was local people that did the welding, the creation, there was never a design for it. It was not even on a drawing pad or a piece of, on a napkin.
It just evolved as we went along.
Would that be the probably the biggest effects challenge you've ever had in any of your films?
The one and only. Well, there was one other later on in with Bigfoot.
I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry.
No, that was a totally different kind of a ball game, though.
I love the giant spider invasion, and it's got such a great cast. How did you get people like Robert Easton and Alan Hale involved?
Well, that was one of my best friends at that time was Steve Brody. And Steve, like many of the old actors in Hollywood, they had a huge circle of friends. So when Steve and I first talked about the idea, I called Steve first and I said, "Steve, listen, I'm going to have to put a cast together for the spider picture." And even then, it wasn't the giant spider invasion. And we sat down in Hollywood. I flew out to Hollywood. We brainstormed it over a few drinks, and before we knew it, we called Bud Hale in to sit down and talk about it. And it was a great idea: get away to Wisconsin and have some fun and make a picture. And then the distributor said, "We're going to need a rewrite for the screenplay." And if I recall, Richard Huff in Madison did a second draft of what we had first presented, and it was absolutely unacceptable to the distributor. He says, "You got to get another writer," because I didn't have time to get involved in the writing end of it at that time. So, through Steve Brody, Bob Easton came in, who was also a writer. And the first time he saw the script, he came to the meeting. He says, "Bill," he says, "this is, can't make this. I wouldn't want to be involved in it. It's that bad." I said, "Yeah," I said, "but all the ideas for the production are in my head." I said, "I know what we can deliver production value-wise." So the distributor insisted that Robert Easton get involved in the writing. So we commissioned him to do a rewrite.
Okay.
Well, as soon as we got into Wisconsin and started writing, he and Richard Huff couldn't get along, because Bob Easton was the one really responsible for coming up with the camp concept of it. He says, "Look," he says, "you can't take this serious. You got to make it funny and campy and show it for what it is." And the ideas that he came up with, I thought, were brilliant.
Yeah, that's one of the best parts of the film, is it doesn't take itself serious, so it's just a good, fun watch.
Well, if we would have not had lines like we did Rice Krispies and Rabbit Turds and not that one, the big one, and I brought you some hot rocks and all this stuff, it would have never made it to be a cult classic.
Yeah, exactly.
And by the way, those things were never committed to script form, those things. Those lines were something that Bob, on the set, came up to me and says, because we didn't have a script to start with. The entire picture was shot without a screenplay.
Really?
Yeah, because Richard Huff and Easton were fighting about the development of the script, and one would write 5-10 pages, send it to the other. You go back and forth between Madison and Tomahawk, Wisconsin, which is a long drive. It's a 3-hour stretch. They would go back and forth. Nothing could get done. First day of shooting had arrived. I think the money just got in the final budget got in the bank. two or three days before the first shooting date. And so it went back and forth.
So did your cast do a lot of ad-libbing, or was Easton just kind of feeding them lines on the set, or?
A hell of a lot of ad-libbing as we went, and I never knew where to lead the next sequence to, because I didn't know how the hell how it's going to end. You know, that was the dilemma.
Turned out well, though.
How in God's name can you direct people, a professional on top of it, you know? The director is supposed to be in charge.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I, knock on wood, I did do that. I remained in charge because I had to do the daily chores of shooting and getting two or three pages at a time. I said, where's the rest of it? Well, we're working on it. So I would get two or three pages, pass it out to the actors, talk it over, go over it, and say, okay, this is loose. We can do this, we can do that, we can do that. Let's give it a shot. Just try it once and go through it. And they were such pros. It was easy that way because of that.
Excellent.
They knew, all of them knew my problem, and I, of course, had to sympathize with these, well, with these super experienced pros. But, you know, in this business, this stuff has happened before. They knew it, but the audience won't know it, how this comes together.
Cool.
I wonder, even today, of how many people have been exposed to that kind of a schedule with the pressures behind that without having a screenplay in your hands.
You know, I can't imagine a lot, but I have to tell you, to be honest with you, I've seen a lot of movies. I've watched a lot of you know, B movies, and I can always tell when there's a movie that's a lot of ad libbing is going on. And I never would have thought that of the giant spider invasion. So that was, I mean, you must have had a great cast and knowing what you're doing.
Well, I was in the habit, you know, after so many feet of film of industrials and, which were all, by the way, well scripted and well thought out, but I always had an opportunity, and I was in a position to change things as we went. I didn't have a lot of advertising agencies, people standing behind me and saying, well, this has got to be done this way, this, that way, and that way. So by the time I got the giant spider invasion, I think I can safely say that I was seasoned enough. But yet, there was some intimidation, you know, when working with people like Bud Hale. God, I remember him from, and his father, for God's sake, you know, Alan Hale Sr., from the old Black and Whites, which I watched on Turner Classics, and I said, shit. These guys had been there and had been around the blocks 100 times. And here we were in Wisconsin, but it was a team effort. We all knew our own problems and aware of the situation. And when you're a pro, you just do it and get it done.
Cool.
There's no hemming and hawing around there.
Yeah, I'd like to jump ahead a little bit, just a little bit, and talk about the Bigfoot picture that you did, which. I've always been fascinated by how popular the Bigfoot movies got and then how they just sort of disappeared. What brought you to doing a Bigfoot picture yourself?
Well, that was another intriguing subject matter. And, you know, in those days you had to look for what the hell is hot today? How do you satisfy the audience out there? How do you do something that sparks the interest of both the distributor and the potential audiences out there? So the topic Bigfoot I was very cognizant of what was going on, and it intrigued me. And I happened to have had an experience a year prior to that on a county road in Lincoln County, Wisconsin, where I, at least even today, I'm sure I had seen one of those creatures crossing the highway. It was an easy mile away, but a huge loping, dark figure loping across the highway. Left to right and disappeared into the woods, and by the time I got there was nothing. But I've told that story 100 times to neighbors and friends and what have you, and that may have sparked the idea of a Bigfoot. And then, well, I think Charlie Pierce had done a Bigfoot picture in North Carolina or Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot what the name of it was, but which was a small town, low budget picture, also very successful. And, well, Bigfoot pictures had been done. And what can you do? Well, what if we capture a Bigfoot? We actually capture a Bigfoot. Well, that took hold. And so we sat down, and I had a cousin in California who was an inspiring writer, whose name is on the credits, Ingrid Neumeier.
Okay.
She was a school teacher and a very inspired writer. I called her, I bounced it off of her, and she said, well, we can do it, no problem. So long distance on the phone, we burned the wires to come up with a storyline and developed, and she did the first draft of the script, and I said, let's go with it. Great. Except because winter was approaching, should it be a Darkfoot, or should Bigfoot change in its, like a mink does, into the winter fur to make the Bigfoot white? And I engaged a guy, Dale Kuypers. I don't know if that name rings a bell with you. Dale Kuypers was how would you call him? Not a special effects. He made museum pieces, lifelike museum pieces. They were so lifelike he couldn't tell the difference from the real thing and from the things he made. He lived in Green Bay. He was a hermit and worked with a lot of chemicals and created historical man. I mean, prehistoric man. But it was all lifelike. Each hair would be a real hair and embedded into the skin. So he impressed me so much. I said, can you make a Bigfoot costume and the prosthetics for it? He says, no problem. So we commissioned him to do the Bigfoot prosthetics and the costume. Well, we got going. He delivered the costumes, the costume. And I kept wondering why it took two strong guys to carry the sucker into the makeup room. Well, because the inner cowling was made out of styrofoam. In other words, if the person got into the suit, he couldn't move. No. We had engaged a wrestler, John Goff, who you probably know.
Yeah.
Okay, John Goff is a friend of mine. He says, you know what, Bill? He says, I got a wrestler. I got a friend of mine down in Pascagoula, Mississippi. Oh, Tiny Frazier was his name.
Okay.
Great, he's huge. Well, he was huge, all right. And the costume was made for a big man like him.
Mm-hmm.
His head hit our ceiling. Well, I'm sorry, that was a basement ceiling, so it wasn't 8 feet. Okay. But he was huge. Okay, so we had the costume, we had Tiny, and And Tiny says, well, how do I get into this thing? Well, the makeup man, Dale Kuyper, says, well, you're laying on the floor. It's laying on the floor. You might as well get down on your belly and crawl into this thing backwards. Well, he did. And it took three guys to help him stand up. And he couldn't move. So that was the first sign that something had terribly gone wrong. In the meantime, I had hired an associate producer from Canada, a friend of mine, who was about 6'3", named Janos Rautkivi. I'm sorry, I have to backtrack here. I don't know if this is of interest to you.
Sure.
So we realized that the suit that Dale Kuypers had made would not physically work for a walking Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to, my daughter, who was the makeup person, we said, let's tear all the styrofoam outside of it, from the inside of the suit out, and just leave the shell, in other words, the fur.
Mm-hmm.
So this is about 3 inches to 4 inches of solid styrofoam throughout the inside of the suit. We just tore the whole thing apart. She reseamed it and everything, put it together. We put it on Tiny, took him outside. We had, at that winter, we had 4 feet, 5 feet of snow. And Tiny, I said, okay, let's see you run with it and whatever. We took the camera, do some test shots and everything, and try and make a run, and he turns out he couldn't run. He couldn't run for two reasons. One, because the snow was too deep,
mm-hmm.
and second, because he had phlambitis, which he never told us about.
So you went from a Bigfoot that couldn't move to one that could just move slowly.
Right. If that.
Yeah.
So one day I looked at my associate producer, Janos. I said, Janos, I said, guess what? I said, your role in this production has just changed. Going from associate producer to Bigfoot. Try the suit on. Okay, so we tried the suit on. I forgot who the special effects, our prosthetics guy was at that time. Oh, yes, we had the mask from Dale Kuyper's, the clay mask.
Okay.
So we poured the skin, the latex skin,
mm-hmm.
and which was adhered to the face, of course, with the makeup cement. Now, what... Another disaster was when it was warm, you know, 50, 60 degrees inside the house in the makeup room. When you take somebody with a prosthetic like that and skin and take him outside, and in 30 below zero.
30 below?
It was 30 below for 4 weeks that year.
Wow.
Right. And we were shooting in 35 millimeter with Panavision cameras.
That had to be a challenge itself.
Well, that was no more. It couldn't be overcome, that challenge, almost. Because, first of all, how do you get a Panavision camera. The Panaflex was a little later. We had to exchange cameras mid-shoot. Because the Panavision camera was too big to transport in the middle of the wilderness, in the woods. And we had snowmobiles, we had sleds, we had dog sleds and dogs and what have you. So the problems that we had in spiders were nothing compared to what we had in Bigfoot. If anything could go wrong, it did. I'm trying to think of some other wonderful experiences in that. Well, yeah, for keeping the cameras hot or warm enough to operate. Exchanging the big Panavision for a Panaflex in the middle of the shoot. And then keeping that warm. So we had tons of heating blankets, electric heating blankets, and extension cords that had to go to some power wherever we could get power. We had to keep heating pads on the camera all the time. And every time we took Janosz, the Bigfoot now, out in the woods to run, he would run 10 feet, start sweating under the latex skin, and the mask would slowly slide off the face. So we had maybe 5-10 minutes to do an action shot, and it all went to hell and start all over again.
So, but did that take a longer time then to shoot the film, or did you still get it within what you had planned?
Oh, no, it took a longer time. It went about, initially, I think it went over $75,000 over budget. And it so happens that in this particular case, my investor and partner was a gentleman who had sufficient funds, but also was in charge of financing. In other words, he was in charge of the budget. Mm-hmm. I had given him that opportunity because he said, going into the production, he said, if we do this, he said, I want to be in charge of the money. Where it goes, how it goes, etc. I want to be, in other words, I want to be my own accountant for it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have any problems with that. I said, it's no problem. I said, you're the man. So we had to turn around every time we have a problem. Dan, we got big problems. Yes, we went over budget. And it was one stint like that after another. If it wasn't the costume, it was the cameras freezing, film breaking. Oh, and then we came to the stunt, the special effects guy. It was out of Atlanta.
That had to be a shock at 30 below from Atlanta.
It was. And there was the, for that we need a high-speed camera. And the only high-speed camera we had was a 35mm BNC Mitchell with a blimp, which weighs about 200 pounds. Now, you try to get one of those suckers into the woods with 5 feet of snow in there. So you had to have a crew that went out and made tracks first. And in those days, snowmobiles weren't built like they were today. They were heavy,
mm-hmm.
were cumbersome. They didn't have the maneuverability as we do today. So we had to first send one crew out to make tracks, then another one, and then bring the camera in with a sled with 5 or 6 guys. Set it up to do a high-speed shot. And the only shot we ever got with that sucker was the one where he chases or runs away from Bigfoot on the snowmobile and comes over the hill in slow motion, takes the dive.
Excellent. One of my favorite movies that you've done, I actually got the first time I saw it, was on 16 millimeter at a convention that I was at, and that's The Demons of Ludlow. How'd this movie come about, and where'd that idea come from?
Well, that one I wrote that in a couple of weeks. And again, it came out of need. We needed something, again, that would be a little more gory and gothic mystery, and that could be done with the locations we had in mind. In other words, I pretty much tailored everything to the resources that I had in my backyard. I mean, it's tough to explain how you develop a screenplay.
So the locations, like the barn and the small town and the houses, they were all close to you or nearby each other?
Oh, yeah. I knew all the locations, everything that could be utilized in the area before I wrote the script and what could be done, how it could be done. And I had it pretty much in my head before I committed it to paper. And then we followed the script pretty closely. Now, that was done, all the sets, all the interiors were shot on stage in the studio. Every interior was built in the studio. I think we had 8 or 9 sets in the big stage.
Now, did that make it easier? Because to do a lot of the... one of the things always fascinated me about this movie was a lot of the traditional effects that I had seen from movies much earlier, like, you know, with the bed and the doors and the piano itself. These were all done on set. Did that give you the ability to do a little extra?
They were all done on set because I, from the beginning, from Invasion, actually, I had always felt that having control over every little aspect of a film would make it easier. We could shoot it faster. We could shoot it better because of lighting situations. We could control it better. And we could put more production values into it. And that's the part that went wrong with Spiders because of no script. That control factor that I built into my head of being able to foresee and control everything as we went along, it was missing because I didn't know where are we going the next day with this thing.
Was this also a cast of people from the area, or?
Yeah, pretty much so. That was pretty much local cast. Paul Benson, who played Cousin Billy in Spiders, he became basically a stock player because he was always gave a good performance.
Cool.
Performance, but it played. I mean, he certainly did well.
I guess one more movie I'd like to talk about is one I just recently found, and that was The Game or The Cold. And I thought that was a really interesting and kind of different thing, and also had an ambiguous ending to it. Was that something that you also, I mean, it looks like you kind of had a good handle on the locations, and it also has a lot of what I consider to be old school Hollywood effects to it, with a lot of the fog machine and stuff like that. How'd that come about?
Well, that was you call that a brain fart. I fell in love with the hotel or this big resort in Three Lakes, Wisconsin. I fell in love with it. I used to go there, stay for a weekend, sit in the pool in the hot tub and dine and look out on the lake and just have a good time. And I said, gee, wouldn't it be nice to do a picture totally controlled in one location? You got the housing here, you got the food here, and develop a little story that fits right in here, how cheap we could make it. So I called a producer friend of mine in London. I said, listen, I got a great idea for a picture called The Cold. He says, what is it? And I explained it to him over the phone. He says, how much is it going to cost? I said, I don't know, about $50,000, $75,000. He says, you're shitting. I said, no. He says, what do you want to do? I said, well, I'll put up $25,000 and put up all the equipment up. You put up $25,000, we'll get our distributor in in California who was handling foreign distribution, have him come up with $25,000. So we made the phone calls, everybody agreed, and we went ahead and did it.
Was that an easy shoot, or did you manage to do it as cheaply as you thought you were going to?
That was an easy shoot, and I think we shot it for about $50,000. Maybe $55,000 with the expenses involved. But it was that's another one-man crew kind of a thing. And like Demons. Demons I shot with, I directed it, I did the cinematography, the lighting, the set design, the set decorating, and I would have the set design and set decorating done before most of the crew came in. I had two key people, a gentleman named Bruce Malm, who was my right-hand man, who could do everything, from editing to shooting to lighting, everything. He was my right-hand guy. He and I would, once the set, where my son was a set carpenter, he built the sets to specification, my specifications. We went in there, we wallpapered it, we did the whole set decorating, the lighting, and then brought the crew in and went to work, and the five people, that was it.
Cool.
And the Cold was done pretty much in the same style and fashion, except we didn't have to build anything, it was all there.
Well, I'd just like to thank Bill Rebane for giving us this wonderful interview. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I enjoyed recording it. And again, the guy's one of my personal heroes. I love these goofy movies, and I was glad to talk to him. So I guess what we'll do here now is we'll take another short break. And when we come back, we're going to go ahead. I'm going to go ahead and be joined by Steve, and we will talk a little bit about The Demons of Ludlow. We'll be back right after this on the Gut Munchers Podcast.
Hey, man, dig this real gone show for a crazy thriller. It's Monsters A Go-Go, a horror thriller with the Go-Go beat, live on stage from Hollywood. See the Teenage Frankenstein. See
Help, I need somebody. Help,
the Beatles mystically transformed. See Hollywood's golden Go-Go girl, Pat Collins. See the ethereal materialization of 007 as James Bond. It's the kookiest and the spookiest. It's where the action is. See Monsters A Go-Go. Terror walks off the stage and into the audience. Free 2-for-1 pass to anyone who can sit through the entire show. And it's all live. This is the only show that gets away with murder. So come early and get a seat. If you're late, we may put you in a coffin. See Monsters A Go-Go. Monsters A Go-Go. Monsters A Go-Go. Monsters A Go-Go.
Hello? Is anyone out there? This is Brother D. Is anyone else alive? You know, you'd think with all the zombie movies I watch and review for Mail Order Zombie over at www.mailorderzombie.com, I would have been better prepared for the zombie uprising. I mean, every week I'd watch anywhere from 1 to 3 zombie movies, and my wife, Miss Bren, would join me in every episode to go over listener mail and even occasionally join me in a review of a zombie movie yourself. But now, we woke up one morning and the zombies have taken over. Miss Bren went scouting for supplies, but she's been gone a long time, so I went out to look for her, and now I just wish I'd stay home and watched more zombie movies for everyone, weeding out the good ones from the bad. What? Wait a minute. Who's there? Miss Bren? You're not Miss Bren. Oh no!
Send more podcasters.
Each night when I come home, I find myself alone. My baby's never there. She doesn't even care. Well, I know she had to go.
And we're back. Well, as promised, here's one of the two movie reviews. First up will be The Demons of Ludlow. Joining me on this review, because my man Jason, as I had stated earlier, had to move to Japan and couldn't be here, is Steve. Hey, Steve.
Hey,
how you doing?
Pretty good.
Pretty good?
Yeah.
Cool. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about the Bill Rebane classic, and I use classic, I guess loosely here, Demons of Ludlow. This is one of my personal little favorites. I really enjoy this movie. What you got here is you have a, excuse me about that, what you have here is a story about a haunted piano that gets returned to a small town called Ludlow by the family of one of the founding fathers of the town. Unfortunately, at some point in the past, this guy, who his family had given the piano back, had been run out of town, and you find out as the story unfolds, he was not a nice person. He did a lot of really weird, creepy things, and the local townsfolk really didn't like him. And at some point, they punish him by, and I don't want to give too much away, but they do some things to punish him. And now, when this piano comes back, he actually apparently was a bad guy because it's got all sort of supernatural powers. There's ghosts, I guess you might want to call them demons. And as this piano gets back in town for the 200th anniversary of Ludlow, Ludlow's founding, as they play it and as things continue to happen, all of a sudden all of these supernatural ghosts and demons and bad things happen to the families that, you know, basically he's getting a revenge on the descendants of the families who had done a bad thing to him way back in the past. So there's all sorts of wackiness that will ensue, which I'm sure we will discuss shortly. But to start off with, let me ask you, Steve, what'd you think?
Well, of course, I watched this on Google Video, so the images was not that great. But I don't know. Like I'm thinking that, you know, it's. I guess I was hoping for more special effects and a little bit more action. But you know, I can see why some people would like it for, you know, its camp quality. But I didn't. I guess I'm gonna say I didn't care for it that much.
You didn't think the super high tech laser beam effects were awesome?
And the glitter effect on the demon arm or whatever the heck that was.
Oh, the glitter effect. Ooh, the glitter effect was awesome. Yeah. Well,
yeah.
Yeah, the special effects. The only thing I do want to say about the special effects I thought were pretty cool is that one set they built with the bedroom where the bed was flopping around. It was like old school Hollywood and things were flying around.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I thought that was pretty cool, but yeah, I will agree with you. A lot of the effects were pretty, I don't know, pretty basic. It almost looks to me, of course, I'm a big fan of the 50s and 60s. It almost looks to me like, you know, like when they did some of those like light effects, they were all, like they were scratching the film. You know how they used to go in and scratch the frame so you get that weird look.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
that was kind of strange. The special effects are sort of goofy. I can't deny that, but something that Jason Payne actually pointed out when we were talking about the movie that he thought he got a kick out of. What about the killer popcorn where they're throwing the popcorn and stuff? One of the kills, yeah. I don't remember if they actually kill her, but one of the things where they terrify this old woman are these people in pilgrim outfits throwing popcorn on her. I thought that was pretty cool. But you know, overall as a story, I don't know, dude. I mean, I guess for me, it's one of those things where, well, let me tell you the first time I saw this movie, because I had seen a lot of the other Bill Rebane movies, like Giant Spider Invasion and Monster of Go-Go, I think is what his first movie's called, which is, I mean, if you've listened to the interview, it's awful, and he admits it's awful. He doesn't have good things to say about what happened with that one.
I've seen that one.
Yeah, it's pretty bad, and even he admits it's pretty bad. He didn't actually finish it. I think he sold it to H.G. Lewis, and H.G. Lewis threw some shit together and put it out. It's all in the interview, which you guys have listened to by now, hopefully, because I can't imagine why you would skip the Bill Rebane interview to listen to Steve and I talk. Normally, it's the other way around. Skip Steve and I talking to listen to Bill Rebane or to the interview. But for this movie, the first time I saw it, actually, dude, was on 16mm at Cinema Wasteland.
Wow.
Yeah, so like the very first time I saw it was on film, it was scratchy. So now it's funny because I did, this is one of those movies, and you're probably going to like, you know, want to hit me with a brick when I say this. But this and there's a few other movies like Dawn of the Dead, which obviously is a much better movie, that I do actually tend to go back and watch every year. At least once a year I go back and watch them. And I really like this movie, but I think it might just be because it kind of, some about this movie with me clicked and kind of takes me back to the point where I was at the, you know, watching things in the drive-in. So when I sit down and watch it, I just kind of get this vibe and this feel that it's like, it's like an old drive-in movie. So, you know, I guess, I don't know. It's, for me, that's, it's kind of one of those, I don't know, I get a really good vibe off of it, you know, when you say you can understand some of the cheese, I guess some of the appeal there, do you not get that vibe from the movie, or?
To me, it seems very, I don't know what the budget is, but very low budget. I don't know if they couldn't do some of the things they wanted to do, or they had to change the story to meet the budget, but I don't know. I mean, I'm a big fan of Giant Spider Invasion, but this one, I don't know. It took a long time, in my opinion, for stuff to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, I can't say, narrow down what I think is missing. I guess it's just a certain thing. Maybe I'm repeat viewings, or if it ever actually does come out, I guess it is in public domain right now, so if I ever see like a really cleaned up version, that might change my opinion a little bit.
God, I doubt there's probably even, well, there might be good film stock somewhere for it, but.
Yeah.
Just to let everybody know, when you said you watched it on the internet on Google, it is in the public domain, so you're either going to catch it on the internet for free, which is cool, or I also know that it's on quite a bit of like the Mill Creek budget DVDs, so you can pick it up there too. I think there's like a 20 pack of Demons and Devils that it's on. I can see what you're saying about it cleaned up, but for me, almost it'd be like, I don't know, I don't want to see it clean up, you know what I mean? For me, kind of, it's like, it's screwy. And plus, all right, how can you not love a movie that starts off with a hoedown in Wisconsin, even though I think, did they ever say that where it was supposed to be taking place? Because I think they keep trying, with using the name and the fact that there's these random pirates, I think they were trying to, like, push it off as New England.
Yes, that's what I was getting as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they ever say, but I think they're trying to be in New England. But it's funny because if they're trying to say that, if you watch, all the cars have Wisconsin license plates.
Well, the hoedown at the beginning. That hoedown at the beginning, that's why it's like, okay, I got the idea.
You know, it ain't a movie till you got yourself a hoedown.
Yeah, and there's a lot of hoedowns in New England.
Oh, yeah. Being from New England, or having lived in New England for 6 years, I can tell you all the little towns are having these hoedowns. I love it. There's like so much weird shit in this movie that you're just kind of like, really? Because, you know, you got the, they keep talking about the piano. I will tell you, I thought the idea of like this haunted piano was kind of cool. The one thing I did find amusing is like, you know, all these things keep coming out of the piano. It's like, didn't anyone notice like the evil runes written all over the damn thing? but it just is at one point, and it was so damn random. Like they're trying to destroy the piano or do something with the piano, investigating it, and there's like no mention of anything nautical in the entire damn movie up to this point. And then all of a sudden, three ghost pirates show up, and talk about a Scooby-Doo moment. I mean, three ghost pirates show up, and they have to do battle with the ghost pirates, and I'm just kind of sitting there going, really? Ghost pirates? Are you kidding me?
But,
sometimes a movie, for me anyway, and I don't know, I'll let you speak to this, but sometimes when I'm watching something, it can get so retarded that I like just go, okay, I'm going with it, I don't care.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few movies like that that I, you know, are really horrible. And, maybe this one's not to that level. Maybe that's why I didn't get
it's
to that
bad,
point where I
was good yet.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know, dude. I mean, there was that, and then, now, the one thing I did find, and of course, maybe it was a budget, but I just didn't, I don't know, dude, I didn't think the kills were all that fantastic, though. I mean, and of course, this is a low-budget movie, but I think it's from 83, so it's not even like in the 70s. It was like, I think it was early 80s it came out.
Right.
I dig some of the special effects. Some of the special effects are bad. You know, throwing popcorn at the little old lady. Oh, my God, I'm going to die. I mean, you know, that's kind of funny, but I don't know, man. hey, I got another question for you, though. What did you think when the ghost pirates did show up, though? I mean, did that confuse the hell out of you, or were you just like, hey, cool ghost pirates?
I was like, for a second, I thought, well, is that their colonial garb or what? and it's like, no, they kind of look like they're, you know.
Well, they had the sabers and stuff. Mm-hmm.
Who knows if that was really what they intended to, or if that's all the costumes they could find. They used all the colonial costumes, so all we have left over is pirate costumes.
You know, the funny thing is, dude, and go with me on this, because I'm not comparing the two movies, because one movie is way superior to the other. So this isn't like, hey, they're the same movie. But was I the only person that kind of noticed the fact that, you know, with you have the town founders doing something? Yeah, of course you have the haunted piano, which is mm-hmm. unique, and the guy, that ghost coming back, which is unique. But if you have, like, the whole New England setting and the town, like, anniversary and pirates and ghosts running around and some of the vibe, dude, did you kind of get a Fog vibe off of this thing?
Yeah, I mean, I did. I was reading online a little bit of it, and the Fog, I mean, as far as the Fog reference came up, and then, yeah, I mean, it does have a similar thing, so maybe that had a little bit of inspiration, or I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, yeah, let's use inspiration. It's an homage to the Fog. You see, it's an homage to the Fog. But yeah, I mean, you know, this movie's kind of weird because it's not great.
Mm-hmm.
I do kind of like it, and you know, here we are doing the review. And if you guys haven't noticed yet, I mean, this is tough for me, Steve, because this is one of those movies that I really like and I do enjoy watching, and I'm not. You know, I get a feeling sometimes, oh, I love that movie. It's like, no, you don't. It's a shitty movie. Oh, I watch it all the time. No, you don't. You're just saying that because it's cool to, like, hate crappy movies. I actually do watch this movie all the time. But it's weird because, or at least I should say at least once a year, and I've watched it many, many times, and I do enjoy it. It always puts a smile on my face. But I'll be damned. If somebody tried to have me explain to them why I enjoy it, it is tough. So I'm here struggling, being like, well, yeah, I like this, I like that, you know, I know it's not very good. You know, like you said, the special effects, I'm like, yeah, the special effects. And I'll admit that, you know, the kills aren't very interesting. And the movie, excuse me, the movie does drag. I think in the middle part of the movie, it drags pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
I actually, you know, starting with the hoedown in the first couple of murders, which, isn't it weird? Do they disappear or do they find the kids' bodies? I think they find the bodies, and they're just kind of like, well, that was weird. I don't remember.
I don't think they did find them.
No, I think they just. I think you just find the two kids died, and they think they elope or something. So
yeah,
so
exactly. They think they eloped and left.
So it's like the ghosts, like I guess, hid the bodies or something. and, you know, so but it's just it's kind of weird. And then the minister dude. I mean, dude, I can't imagine a town where the minister's married to the hottest chick in town.
I was gonna say that, yeah, and she's drunk too.
And she's a drunk. And, yeah, I'm sitting there watching that movie, and they keep putting her in them skimpy outfits, and then I'm just like, mm-hmm. Well, all right, you know, stop playing around. You know, either show us something or stop teasing us. But you know, I don't know.
Well, we got to see that little crazy chick. The ghost rip off her top.
That's true. That's true.
So I'm like, hey.
Oh, there you go.
That's one good part.
There's some bosoms.
Yeah, young bosoms.
Yeah, but oh yeah, and then the crazy pilgrims. I will have to say this has probably got the best crazy pilgrims of any movie I've ever seen. I mean, I can't think of a better crazy pilgrim movie. Because I mean, just to let people know, one of the things is it keeps going. The ghosts that come back, which I don't know if this were this dude's followers or something else, but the ghosts mm-hmm. that come back are all in like pilgrim garb. They're all dressed like pilgrims. So you have all these like ghostly pilgrims running around getting liquored up and throwing popcorn at people. And people then freaking out and dying from it. Or, you know, just freaking out. But yeah. Which I would have thought, hey, if you're gonna go with the pilgrims or if you're gonna have minions, why not stick the pirates on everybody? I mean, the pirates have swords which do damage. And then
right,
you know, But
well, those cannibal pilgrims, because they were eating on that girl.
I forgot. Dude, this movie is so weird. Because that's sort of inexplicable. It's like, well, okay, I guess they're ghosts, or are they demons, or whatever.
Yeah.
So they're demon pilgrims, and then suddenly they decide to eat somebody. And then the demon pilgrims eating people aren't bad enough, so now we have, like, ghostly demon pirates that show up. But, I don't know if people are getting the vibe, I mean, from our discussion, because our discussion's all over the place, and it's like, oh, shit, yeah, they were cannibal pilgrims. If people haven't figured out yet, Steve, this is a pretty, I don't know, weird movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a lot of different things going on in it, so, I mean, it's like, hey, they're cannibals, hey, they're ghosts, you know, it's just, hey, they're pirate ghosts.
Maybe they're cannibal pirate ghosts. Who used to be pilgrims.
Right.
And it's like suspend the disbelief, people, because, I mean, they keep acting like this is New England. Just ignore the Wisconsin license plates, okay?
Yeah.
So.
It's all Wisconsin people on vacation in New England at that time.
Yeah, that's it, definitely. I don't know, dude. I mean, now... I don't know where they found this little town they shot in, because I'm trying, you know, basically there's some good stuff. It's cheesy, it's odd. I think some of the locations are pretty good. It does look like this little, like, when they're shooting out in the middle of nowhere in this little crap hole town, it is really in the middle of nowhere, crap hole, Wisconsin. So, I mean, that worked for me. Some of the cheesy special effects worked for me. You know, I'll admit, dude, I'm sitting there kind of watching a lot of the movie going, what the hell? Seriously? Like, you know, and we've already gone over a lot of that, but I do kind of like the ending, and I don't want to give the ending away, but I did not see that coming. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I'll just tell everybody, spoiler alert, you know, whatever. If you don't want to have any more spoilers, stop listening now, because I've been holding off on a lot of stuff, but damn it, I want to talk about it. So, if you don't want to have Demons Let Alone spoiled, pause the podcast right now, hop on your computer, go to Google, watch the friggin' movie, and then come back and listen to the rest. But, dude, I was kind of shocked. I mean, and, you know, the first time I saw it, I was kind of shocked that the guy that I thought was the hero actually ends up the way he does.
Yeah.
Basically, it seems to me like they wiped the entire town out except for the one reporter chick.
Yeah, I mean, that was, I thought, you know, the demon, I guess the main baddie lost his hands. They cut his hands off, and I thought, well, maybe...
If I remember right now, the whole story is his daughter dies, and he flips out, and
plays
that piano all the time, and has a bunch of, like, I guess, parties and orgies and shit at his house, and people flip the hell out, and that's, I mean, and I that's what always confused me, because I didn't know if those people were ghosts of the people that were participating, or whether he had summoned demons through playing that piano or some shit.
Right.
But yeah, like you said, is they figured out, I guess the town figured out, all his power was in that piano and when he played. So they cut his hands off, which I don't think they ever truly explained that till right towards the end.
Yeah, and I figured that they would go dig up his hands or some shit.
Yeah.
But they took the more direct approach of he got the preacher's hands.
Yeah.
They cut his hands off. And
then basically it's like Ludlow's effed, and the reporter gets away and end a movie. But
she runs into a force field.
Yeah, that was another piece of special effects that's also
that went on like for freaking ever. She kept on touching it. It's like, how many times are you gonna touch this?
Well, Steve, you know, they actually had their effects budget, damn it, and they got the end of the movie and they're like, oh, we can do this effect, so let's put it on for 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's true. I guess we got a little cash left over. Let's hit a more blue sparks.
Yeah. Well, you know, that blue sparks, whenever I was talking about in the old school, you know how they did that, right? They would go through frame by frame and scratch.
Yeah.
So you would get, you know, as you scrape off the layers of film, you'll get those weird-ass colors.
Right.
So when they went back to the film stock, somebody went through and went scratched it off
and
they printed those. That was, I mean, you know, that's pretty old school. And I guess for me, that's one of the things that appeals to me is like, I talked about they built that one set for the bedroom attack, and the bed can lift up and things would fly around. Well, when I was talking to Bill Rebane, and I'm not sure this made the interview, but when I was talking to Bill, that was the one, I mean, everything else they shot interiors were actually the interiors of the houses they shot, but they built that bedroom set for her. And he rigged it up so they could do all of that. And that's like old school Hollywood, like screen, right? You know, basically a set that was built on a tilt so they could tilt it around and do all kinds of funky stuff. And then scratching the film like that, it's old school Hollywood. So I just thought it was amusing because, I mean, they were flying by the seat of their pants, but they were shooting something in 83 like they'd have shot it, in, you know, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. So I just thought that was kind of cool, but yeah, I mean, story wise, I don't know. I mean, I think the movie starts out cool with the hoedown. It got my attention, and you know, and I'm a fan of the movie. I'm not lying. I mean, so this is an honest thing. And I thought the ending was at that picked up when it got around the dude. As soon as a pirate showed up, I think things just got like so goofy and weird. It was fun again. But there's a part in the middle there where I'll admit is you lose a lot of people. I've shown this to my friends and I've had a lot of people nod off in the middle of the movie. So
yeah, I can imagine.
Though between you know after watching all the European classic films that you have, I'm hoping that you had your tolerances built up enough to make it through the first time.
Yeah, I've said the worst. So yeah. Trust me.
Yeah. So. So, what else you got? Anything else you want to talk about the Demons of Ludlow?
No, I can't think of anything about that. But I am a big fan of Giant Spider Invasion. I've seen that about, I don't know how many times. I actually watched it with the Mystery Science Theater. They did an episode about it with their comments and stuff, and it's one of the very funniest episodes they have. So I'm really enjoy your Giant Spider Invasion.
Cool. Very cool. Very cool. Actually, then, I tell you what. Why don't we take a quick break, and when we come back, maybe we'll talk a little bit about Giant Spider Invasion. Back
all
right after this. Oh, wait. Before I forget, though, before we go, all right, I almost screwed up. 4-star rating system. I'm a huge fan of the movie, and even I can only give it 2.5. So, what do you got for it?
I guess I'll give it maybe 1.5.
Okay, that seems like fair. So, there you go. Now we can go to a break, and we'll be back right after this. So, yeah, you know what? Hey, that's how we roll here at Gut Munchers, because we are not professional, and you get what you pay for, and all of this is free. So, there you go. We'll be back right after this.
Invasion of the Blood Farmers. Coming in the dead of night, coming to plant the living and harvest the dead. More raw terror, more stomach-turning shock than you can take. We warn you, don't eat before you see Invasion of the Blood Farmers, and you'll have nothing to lose.
Stop it!
Invasion of the Blood Farmers, released by NMD Films, in color, rated PG.
Well, and we're back, and now we're going to talk a little bit about the second movie that we're viewing this week, and again with me is my good buddy Steve. How's it going, Steve?
Great.
You had mentioned in the earlier segment on Demons of Ludlow, the other movie we're going to review is the Bill Rebane classic, and I was a little tongue-in-cheek with classic Demons of Ludlow because I know a lot of people don't like it, but I think a lot of people have much love for this movie as well as I do, and that would be the Giant Spider Invasion from 1975. Again, this one's directed by Bill Rebane, and I'm going to do a real quick synopsis, and then Steve and I are going to get into chatting about it. And if you thought the Demons of Ludlow was a little weird, holy freaking crap. So basically the story here is a meteor hits near a farm in Wisconsin. Somehow, this meteor hitting the earth opens up a black hole in Wisconsin. And I'm not kidding. The story is the black hole gets opened up in Wisconsin, and through the black hole is a portal to an alternate universe where these little tiny diamond-encrusted eggs come popping out of this hole. Now, the good news is the farmer who owns the farm is like, woohoo, look at all the diamonds. The bad news is the eggs are full of spiders who grow to enormous sizes, like bigger than a Volkswagen. And we'll get back to why we mentioned the Volkswagen here in a bit. And these spiders start to eat the locals, as giant spiders invading Wisconsin are apt to do. You have a group of crack scientists, and or maybe it was scientists on crack, I don't know, that show up are, first of all, investigating all the weird things happening on all their scientific instruments, which basically looks like the front of the science library. Their lab looks like they shot it in a high school science class. And it's like they have like three instruments, and they go, wee! There's something weird going on. It's like, yeah, what are those? Barbara Hale plays one of the doctors, and she's famous for being on Perry Mason. But the real, real killer thing here is Alan Hale Jr., the skipper, plays the sheriff.
Oh, buddy!
Yeah, and I think, isn't his first line, one of his first lines Alan Hale has in the movie, I mean, they're not even playing around. They're not even playing around, but... But basically, one of the first lines that he mentions, I think, is, "Hey, little buddy!" So they're just like, yeah, it's the skipper. All right, come on. You know? This is a super low-budget movie. Cost about $250,000. It is... Well, damn it. It's fun. So, what have I missed, Steve?
Well, we got another alcoholic wife.
Ah.
And the farmer is really pretty much a dick.
Farmer. Yeah, the farmer he's like a creepy son of a bitch, because I think he's the guy who keeps saying, "I'm going to the tent meeting to see the preacher," and he's actually like off with a whore or something.
That's classic too.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I did forget that. And the farmer that finds the diamonds is off running around on his wife with this whore, and then he's trying to hit on his wife's younger sister, who's barely legal, and he gets his comeuppance, though. He gets what's coming to him.
It was great. And there's one scene after the spiders are everywhere. They're crawling everywhere. And, like, doesn't she, like, drink Bloody Marys or something? And, like, one of the spiders gets into the blender.
Yeah!
And she drinks it, and then she freaks out, and then I guess he thinks that she's seeing spiders, so she's going through withdrawals or something.
I think he actually, like, "You're just going through the DTs," because she's like not had any booze. So she's like, "Oh, there's spiders everywhere." But this movie, I mean, it's funny because they obviously had to extend the runtime out a little bit with this movie. So there's like there are some pretty obvious, like, just insert shots of people running around, and I think they probably borrowed some footage from some riots and stuff. If you listen to the interview, what's really cool is Bill Rebane just talked a lot and was really honest about these. Apparently, the first guy, we'd mentioned the Volkswagen, and I just thought this was cool, that the first guy they had to do the special effects just really wasn't getting it done. And I think it was his local mechanic that rigged the whole spider on top of a Volkswagen. So, guys, you'll actually see the spider chasing people around, this big, giant puppet spider, and it's just attached to a Volkswagen Beetle.
I mean, this movie, to me, the reason I kind of like it over Demons of Ludlow is just because of the, it's just inventive. They took the money they had, and it is goofy looking, but if you're really, I'm kind of afraid of spiders, and some of the stuff is not going to be that scary because it's so goofy, but there's a lot of other scenes where, I think the farmer, did he get ate by a spider?
Yeah, farmer gets and they get. Farmer gets chewed up.
Yeah, and it was like that. They got the little teeth or beak or whatever you want to call it, the spider, by pulling him in. Of course, someone's probably on their side pulling him in, but that's kind of scary and goofy. I mean, this is definitely a fun movie, and seeing Barbara Hale and that other actor run around in their leisure suits is pretty funny.
Then the weird stuff is like that. She was the one. They open the ones. She opens a suitcase to get something that, like, when they're trying to close the black hole, and there's like a spider. She goes, "Ee!" dude, it's just so crazy.
Yeah, this is an awesome little movie. You know, this definitely would have been a good movie to see in a drive-in. Because it's that kind of movie.
You know, and it's, I don't know, dude, it's kind of funny. Oh, what's the guy's name? Robert Easton, the one older guy with the beard, the big white beard.
Yeah.
He plays he played the Dan character in the movie. It's funny. Interviewing Bill Rebane, they actually started shooting the movie and they had a script that was really Bill basically. The nice way of saying it is that, the script was too serious, and we had to, write it down to a point where it would fit the budget and also fit the tone of a drive-in movie. But basically, I think Bill actually says right in the interview, it was awful. And one of the things, the actor was out there, he was playing the part of that one character, but he also was rewriting the entire script as they were shooting. And I guess they put a lot of the humor in it, and Alan Hale, basically would just went, all right, you know, he went ahead and did the whole Gilligan's Island thing right off the bat early on in the movie to let you know, hey, you know, this is what it is. So I don't know, dude, I just really like this movie. It's pretty cool. It's not the greatest thing in the world, but you know, it's giant spiders. I mean, a lot of people crap all over this movie, and I don't get it, because it's like, it's a movie called The Giant Spider Invasion. And you have Alan Hale throwing a Gilligan's Island line out early on, and the whole idea of the movie is that a meteor hits Wisconsin and opens a black hole, and giant spiders come out. I mean, how serious do you want to take this movie? Right?
And the poster for this thing is awesome.
Yeah, the poster is very cool. I think actually that was the poster that was up previewing the show. So yeah, the Giant Spider Invasion poster. So. Yeah, man. I mean, I don't know, dude. I guess a lot.
You gotta give them points for not doing back another spider movie, Tarantula from the '50s.
Yeah,
they didn't have any spiders crawling over miniature sets. They went out and built a spider and put it on a dang car.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
they put it on the house too.
Oh, dude. Yeah, the house. I mean, that's actually. Again, people are like, well, it's a shitty little movie. Well, it's like, dude, do you realize how impressive it is in the days? I mean, you know, people could shoot this movie now because they would just CGI everything would look like shit.
Mm-hmm.
Tearing that, they actually took that house apart with that puppet. That was pretty, pretty damn cool.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
you can see. I mean, the legs coming through the cabinets in the kitchen, and I believe there's a barn. There's one in a barn as well. I'm not sure. My memory's a little faded, but I mean, some of that stuff was pretty cool. A lot of it was cool.
Yeah, and you know, it's like, you know, this one was shot in the 70s. They were winging it. They were doing what they could with what they had. And I think for the money they spent and what they were shooting, they got a pretty damn good movie out of it. I think it's funny. I love the characters. I mean, of all the Bill Rebane directed movies that I've seen, this one probably has the most fun with the characters. Barbara Hale's actually a pretty decent actress. Alan Hale Jr. is not in the movie as much as I thought he was going to be, but he does pretty good. Robert Easton is good. The guy that plays the doctor that comes in and works, the guy comes in out of town, I think his name was Steve Brody. He's bad.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm saying nice things about these other people, but the Steve Brody guy was bad.
No, they're hitting a romance between him and Barbara Hale's character.
Yeah, I'm just like...
Kind of a middle... it's a November affair, because they're both kind of senior citizens.
Yeah. I'm just watching it going, really? I would have had more fun if they had put, Alan Hale in that part, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, that would be freaky. I don't know.
Give him more screen time or something, but... But you know, Alan Hale, I mean, he does a pretty good job, and the cool thing about Alan Hale is unlike everybody else, and this is just I'm sidetracking here, but I don't give a damn. A lot of the other actors that were involved in Gilligan's Island, they all wanted to be like, oh, I don't want anything to do with it, it ruined my career. And Alan Hale Jr. was the only guy that was like, dude, I had a lot of money from that, and he was the one guy that always was very happy. You know, to it's like, yeah, you want a skipper type character. I have no problem with that. I'll go do a skipper character for you. And I mean, but it just seems like everything he's in, he's always having a good time. So I mean, people need to get over themselves. But I think this movie, the pacing in this movie is better than Demons of Ludlow. It does bog down a little bit when they do get to the stock footage, because it does seem to me like they were trying to stretch the runtime a little bit with some stock footage. Or some just random footage of people running around from the giant spiders. But, you know, when it's actually the stuff they were shooting for the movie that has the characters in it and dialogue, it's pretty, I don't know, it's pretty well paced. It was interesting. I like Demons of Ludlow, okay? Demons of Ludlow is a good movie. I enjoy it. But I will say that with the Demons of Ludlow, even I will admit there are times where I kind of thought the movie was a little slow and boring. Okay, not this one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think this movie's paced really well.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of chases going on. A lot of, you know, he has a lot of people. When the giant spider is downtown or in the city, I don't know, in the city hall kind of area, you know, there's a lot of people going around. And
yeah, which is funny because, like, when the town they're shooting in with the actors. Is like a really small town, and the way they explain a lot of the stock footage with the bigger buildings and bigger towns. Oh, well, that's the next town over. It's like, oh, the spider invaded the next town over and then came back to the black hole. What are you gonna do?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good goofy movie. That's all you can ask for. Sometimes it's going to be a little goofy. Let's go all the way with the goof.
Well, and you know, the other thing is when you're making a lower budget independent movie, you're always going to run into stuff that's going to be hard for continuity, that's going to be hard to shoot. And sometimes you try to find a way to work around it, and it gets to be a little silly. But rather than, for me, you know, when I look at a movie like this, rather than, like, rip on somebody for, like, oh, that's silly, I, like, go, okay, you know, you obviously had something you had to work around, and you were very creative and got it done. Yeah, and maybe it comes off a little goofy, but you tried. I mean, you know, like, for example, that spider is clearly a car, right? And, in fact, there are a couple of scenes that you see the spider chasing people across the field. You can see the wheel marks behind it. You can see the ruts from the tires. Yeah. But, you know, the thing is it's like you have no money. You want to try to pull the scene off, and you get it done. You get something on the screen that's, yeah, it might be goofy looking, but you got it on the screen, and it looks fun. I don't know, dude, and maybe it's just me being old, but I'd much rather watch something like this than you know, like a sci-fi channel movie with a ton of CGI in it. I mean,
oh, God,
know,
yeah.
It's
kind
of like, you know, the CGI, I don't know. And you know, Steve, it's funny, maybe it's just our generation, because maybe the next generation of kids that grown up on the crap on the sci-fi channel will be like, oh, I love CGI, I love bad CGI. The way we love bad special practical effects, I don't know, but, you know.
Yeah, maybe Kimono versus Cobra will be one of their favorites, I guess. I don't know.
You know, dude, seriously, though, maybe just me being arrogant, but I bet you in 30 years nobody remembers those movies.
I would think not. I mean, they're very disposable, and something like this, you know, about it 30 years later.
This movie's
so.
34 year, or this movie's turning 34 this year.
Yeah,
this movie's from 1975. But this movie's gonna be 34 years old, and I mean, dude, a lot of people crap all over this movie, but people are still talking about this movie. You know, and a lot of people love this movie. So I don't know, man. I really dig it. I really think it's a good flick, and you know, it is what it is. So
yep, it's a good movie for you know, if you just want a Saturday afternoon movie, this is definitely what I would call a good movie for that.
Well, you know what I do every once in a while is I crack this bad boy out when I'm having friends over and we're eating some burgers and drinking a couple of beers. It's a good movie to have on in the background. It's a blast.
Yeah. You turn around and you see some chick in her panties finding spiders everywhere in her panty drawer and stuff. So, yeah.
You're all about the ladies, aren't you, buddy?
I can't help it.
So, well, for me, I'm thinking this is probably, you know, and I don't know why I do this arbitrary thing, but I always like to do it just because it's fun, just to give people, like, the final word, which I think is probably, out of 4 stars for me, a 3-star movie. I definitely, if people get a chance to check it out, I definitely think you should.
Yeah, I agree. I would have given it a 3 as well. I mean, definitely fun movie. Also, like I was stating earlier, if you can ever find it on a Mystery Science Theater box set, definitely would. It's one of the funnier episodes, and they make fun of the movie, but I mean, there's a lot there to make fun of, and it's just a different way of enjoying it.
Yep. Yeah. Well, and other than that, this movie actually is hard to get because it used to be on a lot of the public domain titles, and then somebody claimed they had the rights to it. So I know that Mill Creek pulled it off all the public domain sets. I'm lucky enough to have one of the old public domain sets. Talking to Bill, they were talking about a special edition possibly coming out with all kinds of commentary and everything else. So cool. I don't know if that'll ever happen. That was supposed to happen this year, but I also know he ran into some issues with that. But keep your eyes out. There might be something cool coming, and I'm still in contact with Bill. So he said he'd get a hold of me if anything came up on that. But right now, Giant Spider Invasion is tough to find. Probably your best bet is going to be picking up that Mystery Science Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Even now, right now, it's a tough one to get. So, but it's worth checking out if you can find it. And I do know that, believe it or not, Turner Classic Movies plays it quite a bit.
Yeah, I remember seeing it on there one night.
Yeah, they have it on. I know they've showed it on the Underground a couple of times.
Yeah.
ECM Underground. So it is out there to be seen, and it is worth checking out. I guess that does it for the Giant Spider Invasion. So we've covered the Giant Spider Invasion and Demons of Ludlow. Had a good time doing them. So I guess we'll be back after this, after a few messages here, and we'll do some more stuff. So we'll be back right after this on the Gut Munchers Podcast.
Tonight, meet the twisted genius of Edgar Allan Poe. Experience a terrifying tale of druid witchcraft and the scream that kills.
Cry of the Banshee.
American International presents New Heights in Horror, never before filmed. Vincent Price stars in this new adventure in terror and torture. Don't miss Cry of the Banshee. You'll learn to fear it. Rated GP.
Hope you guys are enjoying the show so far. Next up is going to be the first installment of the Mom and Pop Video Shop, where my man Ed Demko from BloodTypeOnline.com and I take a little trip down memory lane and talk some VHS and what it was like when we were youngins. So without further ado, here's the first episode.
Hey, John. Thanks. Thanks for bringing these back. I appreciate it, and I hope you were kind and you did rewind. But welcome to the Mom and Pop Shop. What can I do for you this week, man?
Do you have any recommendations for me?
Actually, I do. I don't know if you've ever seen this movie, but have it sitting right here. It's going to sound a little strange, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It has Treat Williams and former Saturday Night Live cast member Joe Piscopo, and it even has some zombies in it. It's called Dead Heat.
Interesting. Zombies, huh?
Of course.
Yeah.
What else? I mean, you're in the mom and pop shop. What else are we going to have here?
Well, I think I've actually seen that.
You a fan of this movie?
Yeah, actually, I do love some dead chickens.
True.
Dead chickens are always a good thing, and Vincent Price.
And Darren McGavin,
Darren,
the Night Stalker himself.
I forgot Darren McGavin's in that movie. That's true. Excellent movie.
It's a really cool flick. I think it's really underrated. To be honest with you, I mean, this was a movie that I honestly found out about years ago. I actually rented this one. It was a major VHS rental for me. I don't know why, really, but I guess I just found it funny as a kid. But the thing is, I wanted to talk about this because I don't know how many people are aware of it, and it's really cheap online. Is if you check out the Anchor Bay DVD of this,
mm-hmm.
there's a ton of features on it. It has commentary. There's about, I'd say, like 7 or 8 deleted scenes on it. It has like a promo and an electronic press kit and the theatrical trailer. And it's just a movie that, like, for a DVD that, you know how, like, people always talk about the best DVDs with, you know, the extras and stuff. I never hear this one mentioned, but I thought the extras were great, and you could probably find this one online for like $6. But of course, if anybody out there is interested, Ed's Mom and Pop Shop here, it's always in stock, so you don't have to worry about that.
Would you say there's a lot of extras on it? What else you got on there? I mean, is it deleted scenes? Is there a making of featurette or anything like that?
There's nothing like that. There's something on here. It's really weird. It's a promo, they call it, on the back of the DVD. And what it is, it's kind of like it reminds you of something that the filmmakers would make if they were trying to pitch this movie for a company to pick it up. Like, it has interviews with some of the cast members, and they show clips from the movie and stuff, and it's kind of a cool little thing that they have on here. And it's something that I haven't seen on many DVDs, and that's the one thing that I really think makes it, you know, a really cool thing. But also, it does have audio commentary with the director, who's Mark Goldblatt, the producers, and the writer, which it blew me away that they actually, I mean, this is at the point, like, this DVD came out in 2004, so I guess it was the height of the Anchor Bay stuff, you know, that they were doing on DVD.
Yeah.
And they really went all out on the features for this, because you figure a movie like this in 2004, they would have just thrown the fucking thing out. But they actually went out of their way to put some special features on there, and it makes it a pretty good DVD, to be honest.
Cool. That's funny you mention that, too, because I just recently was checking out Vigilante. And Vigilante, actually, I think, has the promotional reel that they put together. I'm not sure if it was to get distribution or funding, but... So that actually kind of sounds interesting there. Sort of like what Vigilante did, but so did you just recently watch Dead Heat again then, or?
Yeah, actually, I was, you know, browsing a used place, like a used CD store, and I had found a copy for like $3-4, whatever it was.
Awesome.
And so I was definitely going to pick it up. I mean, you know, you can't beat that for this cheap. And it's a movie I've actually wanted to get on DVD for a long time. And I actually had a burn copy of it that didn't work. So it's a movie I've definitely been trying to pick up for a long time, and I was glad to get it again. It's been a while since I've seen it. So I definitely recommend that people check it out. It's a funny little movie. It's a little cheesy, you know what I mean? It's 80s, and it looks like it's from the 80s. But the thing is, it's weird because it's like Treat Williams at the time, surprisingly, was known as somewhat of a serious actor, and was trying to take like another offbeat role to change his career up a little bit.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, after the Saturday Night Live run that Piscopo had, and his career was kind of dwindling at this point. So, but it's actually a pretty funny, it's like a horror movie with a comedy and a buddy cop movie. So, and then there's like crazy looking zombie people and some pretty solid special effects too, to be honest. So, you can't beat it, especially with it's a very, you know, the cast is very genre-friendly. The guy who did all the special effects, name is Steve Johnson, who did all the makeup effects in Species. The director, Mark Goldblatt, did the Punisher, the old Punisher, by the way.
Dolph Lundgren.
Exactly. And it has, like I said, Joe Piscopo, Treat Williams, Vincent Price is in it, and also Darren McGavin. And it's a pretty cool movie. It's definitely offbeat. If you're looking for something a little bit different, you know, I definitely think that this one's a little bit different. So highly recommend that one.
It's almost like it's a treasure from the 80s that people have forgotten about.
Yeah, it really is. And it's definitely something that I remember highly from the video store, which, you know what I mean? Like, I used to rent movies all the time when I was a kid, and there was like movies that would get repeated rentals from me, and Dead Heat was probably one of those movies. So it's nice to finally add it to my collection officially. So, but it's something I just wanted to let people know about a little bit on the segment. So,
excellent.
And I figured you'd appreciate that one as well. So,
oh yeah, I don't even know if I have the Anchor Bay version. I think there was an earlier Bare Bones edition before that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think I've had my DVD of that probably since maybe 02 or 03. I could be wrong. I have to go check after. I have to go check the archives and dig down into the vault and see what I have. But yeah, excellent. Excellent.
Yeah, definitely recommend people check that one out. I don't think they will be too disappointed with it, especially, like I said, you can get it online for like $6 probably.
Cool, very cool. So,
but that actually leads me to another point, though, since we were talking about Dead Heat, and it was a movie that I rented quite frequently. What were some of the titles that you rented, like, repeatedly? Like, you know what I mean? Like, even though you've seen them, and there was other movies on the shelf that you hadn't seen, like, what were the movies that you kept on... like, repeatedly renting, like, you know, when you were first getting into the movies and stuff?
I remember my one friend in high school and I almost every weekend would rent the same couple of movies I remember being for maybe a year or so. It was the same two movies every weekend, and that would be Reanimator.
Great movie.
Yeah, and then Evil Dead, actually. Evil Dead and Reanimator were two movies we'd rent on VHS all the time. And it was funny because there was a little video store, a little mom-pop video store. We'd go in, and they'd see us coming, and we'd rent those two. And then we'd mix it up, a third movie in there with them. And then that would be our Saturday afternoon into the evening.
Cool.
So, but yeah, it was always a combination of those two and something else for the longest time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We probably spent enough money renting them over a year. We could have bought the damn tape.
Well, maybe not back then, because at that point it was probably like the tapes were going for outrageous amounts. Because that's when, like, I mean, there was a time when you couldn't even own this shit. I mean, you had to just rent it and be happy with renting it or copying it onto another VHS.
Oh yeah, and then that was actually when they still had the protection on some of the cassettes. You couldn't even actually tape them. So, believe it or not, it's just kind of retarded. Kind of a funny story, though. My one friend was like gonna, as a goof, rip us copies of Moonwalker onto DVD off of his VHS tape, because we were like, we actually were bored one night and watched Moonwalker on VHS recently, actually. And he went to do it, and it actually had the copy protection, and the new DVD recorder's like, I have no idea what this is, but I can't copy it. Sorry.
Yeah, that is like, funny, actually. Like,
damn, I guess, you know.
They had their shit together in the 80s.
I guess. Or maybe it's a case that's now so damn old that anything that actually would have cracked that, you know, lame copy protection's like, what the hell?
Like, we've never seen this.
Yeah, it's like, what the hell do you need to copy off of that for? But yeah, some of the other stuff I remember renting. Dawn of the Dead. The old photo cover. Remember the old photo cover with Roger?
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. I used to rent that all the time, but
yeah, that's definitely how I was with the Romero stuff. Creepshow was one that got a lot of rentals for me. I was real big, and I mean, like you know, you said you'd go to the video store and like you'd always rent like Reanimator, and you know what I mean, and like you that stuff was like the consistent one, and like for me, it was like I would try and get a couple different ones, but then I would always end up coming home with either Halloween 2 or like one of the Friday the 13th movies, like as I mean, because you didn't own them, so
yeah,
like that was like the first chance for me to get to see them repeatedly. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Especially like the first one, I remember doing that with a lot.
And you know what's funny? Is I remember used to rent them. At least where I went, it'd be like a 5-day rental, so it was like this weird extended rental. So it'd always be like, you know, if you wanted to get stuff, a lot of times we'd go over Thursday night to make sure we had it for the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But then since you had it for so long. And it was, you know, it wasn't really cheap to rent. Did you like watch it a couple of times while you had it out before you returned it?
Probably, because I actually remember a point like, and this is some of my first memories of like renting stuff. But I remember a day and time where like VCRs were pretty expensive, and not everybody had them, and we didn't have one. But the thing was, when you went to the video store, then you would go and you would have a membership to that place. Like you would have to pay to get a membership, and then once you had the membership, you rent stuff, and you would rent like 5 or 6 movies. You would rent the actual VHS player,
yeah,
and you would go home and you'd watch the movies, like you said, for a week. You have like movies and a VCR at your house, and then you take everything back at the end of it, and you know, you wouldn't rent movies again for a little while. But you know, it changed a little bit once, you know, you had the VCR in your house, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
But for me, I would always do that. It would always be like, we would go and rent like 5 or 6 things, you know what I mean? For like the course of like the weekend and whatever, you know?
Yeah. I also remember there was one mom and pop video store that used to carry, a lot of the old Universal stuff. And then for me, what was gold is, they didn't have them all out, but they had a few of the Abbott and Costello movies out.
Mm-hmm.
And those were gold for me. I used to love watching those.
Yeah, I remember that stuff significantly, like at the video store. I mean, that's the thing. When everybody talks about the mom and pop shops, they didn't really have a ton of new stuff all the time. It's just the occasional things that would pop in here and there, except for when like everything got flooded. Because I remember that time period too, where like, you know, like even for me, like around the Pittsburgh area, like where I lived and stuff, and where I rented stuff, in the late 80s, things were still pretty tight. You know what I mean? The video stores are pretty small.
Yeah.
They probably have a bigger porn section than anything. But then all of a sudden, like, I remember going there and looking at the horror movies and, like, them just growing and growing and growing, like, in a small period of time. And I even remember time periods, like, the video store didn't really look down on the horror film like a lot of people do. So you would walk in, and, like, the majority of the store would be that stuff. Like, you would see huge cardboard stands of Leatherface in there, too, along with the other stuff, you know?
You know, it was actually funny because the one store that we used to go to, and this had been probably, I don't know, 86, 85, 87, but they actually, their bread and butter, they didn't carry porn. Because, I you know, it's weird. I was up in Massachusetts, and they had a lot of what they call blue laws. It was just a big generic thing they'd slap down on it, where no alcohol sales on the weekend, you know, and porn was very, very restricted. Pornography was very restricted in Massachusetts.
Okay.
At least in the communities I was in. So, but it would be funny, you go into the video stores, and I remember the store I used to go to, at least half of their collection, and I'm talking about space-wise, too, like half of the store, would be this incredible, incredible collection of horror films. And, I mean, they had everything, you know, Boogans, Ghoulies, you know, everything you could imagine. One, Critters movies. I mean, some of the stuff was a little later, but the Friday the 13th, The Burning, I remember all, and the big boxes, too, the big boxes.
Oh, yeah.
Because they'd have them alphabetical order, but then, like, the top two shelves would just be the big boxes lined up. Dr. Butcher, MD, I think, was one of them.
Remember
I swear
that.
To God, I don't remember if the, I swear to God, in my head, I can see a big box of zombie, but I don't remember if there was one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was. That was the one that, I think I've told you the story before where, I mean, I'm a huge Fulci nut for anybody who doesn't know who I am or has never heard me on anything here. I love Fulci movies, and obviously, you know, I've seen the majority of them on video and through DVD and stuff like that, but the first memory I have of anything Lucio Fulci is that zombie cover. And out of all the stuff in the video store that I would rent, for some reason there was something against that cover that I just couldn't watch it. I would not rent that movie, man. It bothered the shit out of me as a kid. It's just, I don't know what the feeling was, but it's for some reason I could not. I mean, I even remember having it in my hands a bunch of times, like, I'm finally gonna rent this movie, and I ended up never renting it. And I mean, I seen it on, you know, later. But at the same time, though, I vividly remember that cover scaring the shit out of me, and it was the big box VHS.
You know what's funny as hell, though?
What's that?
I have a similar story. The Dead Pit. Remember everybody remembers the Dead Pit VHS cover. It came with the batteries, and the eyes flashed at you.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw that on the shelf for literally at different video stores for years. And you know, I never actually watched the movie until it came out on DVD. I always picked it up and thought, I gotta rent this, and I always put it back. And it wasn't that it freaked me out, I always ended up getting something else, and it was weird because it was like, I distinctly remember that case, but I never saw the movie until it came out on DVD.
Yeah, it was, there was something else too that was really weird that I remember. It's a story I told you a bunch of times about the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre scaring the shit out of me, because I had seen the second one and I loved it. And when I finally got to see the first one in a drive-in, it scared the fuck out of me because I was expecting it to be funny. But one of the things I remember around the time, like, I remember the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre scaring the living shit out of me, okay? And the one thing that made it kind of all better was something that I found at the video store, and I had rented it a bunch of times after I seen the movie. But it's a VHS that was out. It was called Texas Chainsaw Massacre, A Family Portrait, which... Basically, it's a little documentary that talks about the movie and, like, interviews, like, pretty much the whole cast and everything. And it's really cool. It's about an hour long or whatever. But the thing, it's kind of like what you would think of as, like, a DVD extra now, but this was out on a VHS by itself. And I actually have a DVD-R of this now. But it definitely brings back memories of the video store for me, because I used to rent it a lot, because at the video store I went to, somebody had stolen the Texas Chainsaw Massacre from them, the first one.
Really?
So, yeah, and whenever I didn't feel like renting the second one, or even later the third one, I would always rent A Family Portrait. Because it's a cool retelling of the movie, and it's like a making of, and they talk to everybody Which is cool because Jim Sidow's in it, which obviously he's not alive anymore, so he can't be in any more DVD extras or anything like that. So this is one of the best examples of seeing him talk about the role in the movie and everything. So it's a really, really cool thing, so, but it's something I remember all the time renting at the video store.
You know, man, I love having my collection, and I love being able to roll up to Best Buy or pop on the internet or whatever and pretty damn much just, you know, get whatever I want. That's pretty cool, and it's cool having all the stuff at my fingertips. But in a way, dude, I do miss it. I do miss the mom-and-pop video store. I do miss
absolutely.
VHS tapes.
Yeah, and you know what's cool, though? I will say this. It's unfortunate because it's gone, but I know it's something that me and you actually got to experience when you came and visited us here in Pittsburgh. But it was the Incredibly Strange Video, which was like one of the last mom-and-pop shops to kind of be like, you know, the place that we're talking about. You know what I mean? And it was it's unfortunate that it's gone, but it was cool to kind of like relive that, even though like you're a little bit older, because for a while they rented stuff and then they only sold stuff. But it was just a nice, it had the atmosphere that those old stores would used to have. You know what I mean?
True.
But
then, you know, like everything else, the business changed and I mean, you know, I Netflix because there's nowhere around here left to rent. But, you know, it does kind of suck.
Yeah, I mean, especially whenever you have a decent collection of stuff, you know what I mean? Because then you kind of run, I mean, all these movies, like the stuff that we've mentioned already on the show is stuff that we probably both already own. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
So there's no more going and renting Reanimator because it's sitting on your shelf and it's been there for years. You know what I mean? You've seen it as many times as you've ever wanted to see it. So, I mean, in that way, it's cool, but it's just in the, I guess maybe in the modern society that we have where everything's hurry, hurry, rush, rush, that it's just turned into that. There is no more joy to go into the video store, at least not for me. When I go to rent stuff at the video store anymore, it's horrible. I'm just like kind of in and out. It's, I don't want to stay in there and really do anything because there aren't video stores left anymore.
The only thing I do in a video store now is if I know there's something I want, I'll go get it. But I hardly even do that with Netflix. I mean,
yeah.
Now all I do to go to the video store is to browse through the stuff that they've got on the, I mean, you know, my local Hollywood video store picked a bunch of stuff up just Saturday in the $3.99 dirt cheap. We got to get them out of the store because we've got our rental out of it already. And I picked up a bunch of stuff like that. But yeah, the video store is just, yeah, not even that big of a deal anymore.
No,
luckily,
it's not.
We still have the mom and pop segment with Ed Demko. So
yeah.
Still relive it a little bit.
Hey, this is the mom and pop shop that's never going to close.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We're open 24 hours a day. You know, there's no membership fees here. And, you know, it's just kind of fun.
True.
We're making the fun part of this stuff fun again.
We just need to make the show scratch and sniff so that you can, like, you know, get that kind of, I don't know what it was. It always kind of, every video store I ever went to sort of smelled like wet cardboard, cigarette smoke, and if there was a porn section, it was always a little bit skeezy, too. There was that, you know, the one part of the store that just smelled a little bit of skeezy, you know, so, but maybe we'll try to figure out some way to make, technology, see, there's got to be technology where I can make it scratch and sniff on your iPod.
Yeah, like, or if you could
get on that right now,
make some crappy popcorn, maybe burn it. You know what I mean, like that. So, like, if you do all this stuff at once, you can have that aura again while you're listening to the segment.
Yes, you can.
Yeah, you can.
So, yeah, DVD killed the VHS, but then I guess the mom and pop video store killed the horror host too. So,
it's true, and that actually reminds me of something I wanted to mention for everybody on here, since you mentioned the horror host. Obviously, it was a big part of my childhood, and I know it was yours too, like the general horror host. But there's a new DVD out, and people who are fans of the old midnight movie shows and stuff like this, you guys have to check this out. And it's called American Scary, and it's basically a documentary that's a tribute to like the golden age of all the horror hosts. And I mean, this thing has everybody on it. I mean, you see people like Zachary and Svengoolie and Vampira, and they actually interview these people. Obviously, they have the guys from your area.
Yeah, Big Chuck and Little John, and before them, Hula and Big Chuck. And they even managed to dig up some old footage of Goulardi,
Yeah.
So yeah, that was cool. That was very cool to see. I mean, Gould already passed away a while ago, but yeah, that was awesome.
And also, they have my favorite, which would be, I'm from Pittsburgh, and Chili everybody Billy. Would Chili Billy Cardilli from people know him as the reporter from Night of the Living Dead. But dude, I mean, honestly, I got this for review, and I checked it out, and I contacted you immediately. I'm like, dude, you have to see this.
Yep.
And I know you really enjoyed it because I'd read your review. But I mean, like, how much fun was this DVD?
You know, man, I watch this DVD, and I put this into my review as well. But I'm watching it, and there's little bits and pieces of you know, the shows as well as interviews, and I just loved it. But the thing that really got to me, and of course one of the people's not actually a horror host. Forry Ackerman is on there too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Vampira and I forget the fellow's name, but the fellow that did it out in Seattle or San Francisco. But there's like two or three people that they interviewed that are gone now. Just in the 2 years that they, you know, two or three years it took to get the DVD out to people,
mm-hmm.
that they've since passed away. And you know, I just thought it was great because you get to talk, you're looking at people and you suddenly realize, you know, these people are 75, 80 years old, some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And this might be the only shot that a lot of us ever get to see interviews with them, because I mean, you know, Vampire is pretty big, Zachary's pretty big, but some of the other people, like the local people from Philly, the people from Cleveland,
uh-huh.
and you know, Chili Billy Cardile is a big deal, but people like that might not ever. I don't know if they actually, it was just archive with Chili Billy. Did they interview him new?
I'm pretty sure, because I haven't seen all that stuff before, you know.
But you know, these are people that, you know, God love them, they're still with us, but a lot of the local people could be gone, and this might be the only time you get to see them on camera. And I thought that was cool, and I also thought it was really cool they do an excellent job of explaining, or trying to explain, the phenomenon, how it got started with the release of the Chiller package.
Yep.
Which was the re-release of the Universal movies, and they were afraid that some of them were too scary, and then some of them were so bad that nobody would actually want to watch them. So people, they actually put horror hosts with them, that people tuned in to see the host, and the movie was kind of secondary. So I thought that was awesome.
And it's a great DVD. It's really like, if you ever, you know, if you watch horror movies like we do, and you're constantly in, you know, this cycle of movies, and you get kind of down on the genre, or you know, you start thinking to yourself, you might have thoughts of like, why do I even like this stuff? If you watch something like this, you'll figure it out 10 minutes into it, that you're like, okay, this is the fun side of why I love this shit, at least for me. And it was really cool to see these people, because you know what, this is a lot of these people never made a lot of money off this stuff. They did it because they loved doing this, you know what I mean? And a lot of them are local celebrities, you know. Some of them have transcended that and went beyond, you know, they're just actual celebrities, you know what I mean? They're pop culture. And it's just a really cool documentary, I thought. And I think it's a very, very important thing. I mean, if you talk to fans and other people that like this stuff, I mean, you find out that the Midnight movies and the hosts and stuff like that are so important to everybody. And it's good to see a project like this come out. I highly recommend everybody check out the DVD. It's you can't lose with this. It's a total blast from beginning to end. And I know that, like, you know what I mean? Like, I recommended it to you, and I know that you loved it. And I mean, I can't stress that enough to people. It's definitely something everybody should check out. I think people that haven't seen it will absolutely love it, and especially old school fans. You know what I mean? Because there's not a lot of stuff coming out for really old school fans of horror.
Well, and I just, you know, the people who put the documentary together obviously have a love of the genre and a love of what these guys are doing. I do, too. I thought it was great. I gave it, I believe I gave it 4 out of 4.
Yeah, that's what I gave it to. Same here. It's
I just think it's a treasured part of my collection at this point, seriously, and I don't use that lightly. There's certain DVDs that if my house is on fire, after I got my dogs and my wife out, I would run back in, and if I had to grab, like, 20 DVDs, there's certain ones that I would grab. Mostly the out-of-print stuff. And then this.
Yeah.
Insurance will buy all the new shit, so.
Exactly. And And just for anybody out there who's interested, and if this sounds like something cool to you, you can find out more information at www.americanscary.com or check out the people who put it out at Cinema Libre Studios at www.cinemalibre.com. So definitely check that out. It's a can't miss, I promise. It's a great DVD that horror fans are going to love. So check that out if you find it for the cheapest price you can get it, but definitely pick it up or at least rent it. I know you want to see it.
Yeah, you got to check it out if you're a fan of horror. So, but
absolutely.
I enjoyed my first visit to the video store.
Hey man, we appreciate the business. So, yeah.
I guess I'll come back in and stock up again next month.
Cool. Yeah, well, we'll be waiting. And remember, free rentals, no membership fees. You can't beat that. And hey, we're always open. So come back and visit Mom and Pop Shop. And by the way, my name's Ed. So just ask for me if I'm not here.
All right. See you later.
Sound good? Take care.
Bye. Well, guys, that's it for the Mom and Pop Video Shop. We'll be back right after this short break to do the wrap-up and talk about what's coming up for the next episode of the Gut Munchers Podcast. So stay tuned.
A hustler squad. Give them a knife and they'll slice you open. Give them a gun, they'll blow off your head. Pleasure Island became their grave. There was Rose, a condemned murderess who liked to love but liked to kill even more. Sonia, who'd been raped, her family butchered, and wanted revenge. Cindy, who'd do anything to escape the black marketeers who put a price on her pretty head. And Lieutenant West, she picked the pros. Then she became one. The Hustler Squad could do what an army didn't dare. U.S. military intelligence still denies their existence. You'll find out more about them on hotel registers than government records. You pay for the pleasure. The killing is free. The Hustler Squad, a Crown International picture, rated R.
Well, you've gone and done it again, wasted another perfectly good 2.5 hours of your life. Well, 2.5 hours plus of your life listening to the Gut Munchers Podcast. This was episode 3. This was our March 2009 show again. I'm John, and I really appreciate you guys out there sitting down, taking the time to listen to us. Just wanted to let everybody know, if you have any questions or suggestions or just want to generally be part of the show and hear your name and a question read on the air, all you have to do is send us a question via email at gutmunchers@gutmunchers.com. gutmunchers, same spelling, .com. Love to hear from you, and hopefully when Jason comes back, my co-host, the two of us will answer your questions, but until then, whoever's sitting in will answer the questions with me. I also have some plugs. Let's do some pluggage. First of all, Ed Demko helped out with the Mom and Pop segment. I was going to help out in co-hosting duties until Jason gets settled. He runs BloodTypeOnline.com. Movie reviews, all sorts of fun over there. So check him out at BloodTypeOnline.com. Steve, who sat in with the reviews and does Sensei Cinema, Steve Benningfield, has his own project called Eurocult, which I know we've already plugged, but we're going to plug some more. And do check him out at Eurocult. That's cool. Other friends of the show, I like podcasting. I like doing a podcast. I like listening to podcasts. And there's a couple of podcasts in particular that I wanted to mention. My good buddy Goreboy from Goreboy Radio. You can find him on MySpace, or if you do a Google search, you'll find Goreboy. Does a great show. He's English, British, whatever you want to call him. But he's over in merry old England, and he's a blast to listen to, and I really enjoy his stuff. And then Brother D. My man, Brother D, Mail Order Zombie, mailorderzombie.com. Great guy, great stuff, lots of fun. Highly recommend Mail Order Zombie and Goreboy Radio. And in fact, Brother D had me present one of his 2008 Dead Letter Awards on one of his recent shows where they had an award show. So that was pretty cool, and I appreciate that. Speaking of other podcasts, the Gut Munchers podcast is a proud member of the Horror Podcasting Network. And again, it's one of those things, you can do a Google search for the Horror Podcasting Network, or there's a link to the Horror Podcasting Network on the front page of the site. This is a recent development, a very cool group of people, really enjoy it. I'm having a good time talking to them, and it's a collection of podcasters who all are doing genre material of some sort, and I've sampled some of the other shows, and they are all killer so far. So that is the Horror Podcasting Network. Do check them out. Also, another piece of site business that I thought was really, really exciting for me anyway is I was contacted by a representative of the Philadelphia Film Festival, which runs March 26th to April 6th, and we have screeners of some of the things that they're going to be showing at the festival. The first one is up, I Sell the Dead, the first review is up. There's more coming, much, much more coming, so keep an eye out for those. But again, that film festival runs from March 26th to April 6th, and it's in Philadelphia. So if you're anywhere in that area, just based upon the first couple of movies I've already watched, you really want to check it out. They could do some great stuff. Site business. Well, don't forget our weekly webcomic, Gut Munchers, daily movie reviews, and we just opened a new section of the site because, you know, I'm not busy enough with the show, the comic, and the daily movie reviews. We've started what we call the library, which is going to be where we put written reviews of things like books and magazines and comics. The cupboard's kind of bare right now. I think there's four reviews up. So it's still a really new part of the site, but it's something I'm looking forward to doing, and I think it's going to be fun. So don't forget the library. What else do we have? Oh, let's talk a little bit about what's coming up in future shows. Well, I have exciting news, everybody. As I've said, this is our monthly podcast, but since this is episode 3 and now it's time to break some rules, we're going to give you a special bonus episode. At the end of March, episode 4 is actually going to be the very first Gut Munchers staff meeting. Basically, we're going to pull a couple of members of the staff in, and we're just going to talk about a certain topic. There'll be no specific movie reviews. There's no theme. There's no interview. It's just our staff meeting. This one, episode 4, the very first one, I'm going to pull a couple of staff members in, and we're going to do the Slasher Spectacular. We'll sit down, and we'll each have our top 5 list, and we're just going to talk about slasher movies. That's the entire show. I don't know why. Maybe it's because Friday the 13th came out, or the My Bloody Valentine Day remake caused the original to come out. Several staff members have been really, really into slasher movies as of late, including myself. So that's the first topic we're going to do. So again, if you want to ask us a question or make a comment or participate in the slasher show, or, you know, just basically whatever, send us an email, gutmunchers@gutmunchers.com. So look for in about a couple of weeks, end of March, the slasher show to go up. And then the other thing I wanted to mention is that if anybody's in Northeast Ohio, you're going to be able to meet most of the Gut Munchers crew probably at Cinema Wasteland, which is going to be, I think it's the first weekend in April. Check out their website at cinemawasteland.com, cinemawasteland.com. It's a great show. I know Ed's going to be there. I'm going to be there. Steve's going to be there. Scott might be there. So there's a lot of us going to be there. Jason's not going to be there because Jason's in Japan, Jason. But, you know, I'm just to be honest and sincere, I hope that Jason had a safe trip. I know he did, actually, so at this point, so that's kind of silly. But Jason had a safe trip, and, buddy, if you're listening, I hope you're enjoying yourself in Japan. Anyway, I've rambled long enough. Let's go ahead and end it now. So this is been the Gut Munchers Podcast, Episode 3, the March 2009 show. I like saying that, can't you tell? I hope everybody had a good time, and we will see you again in a couple of weeks for the very first Gut Munchers staff meeting. See you guys later. Thanks for listening. I'm John. Goodbye.